You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Flashpoints.
Palomita, palomita, que vagas por la ciudad. Ve, diles a mis hermanos de la pena y la maldad que se vive acá en el norte.
Today on Flashpoints, we celebrate the 69th birthday of KPFA Pacifica with an anti-war speak-out as the world hovers at the edge of World War III. Welcome, everybody. I'm Dennis Bernstein with Miguel Gavila Molina and our troubadour, who we cherish and love, our sometimes co-host, Francisco Herrera.
Palomita, palomita, que vagas por la ciudad. Ve, diles a mis hermanos de la pena y la maldad que se vive acá en el norte. Si vienen a trabajar.
Well, welcome everybody. It is really good to have all of you in here. We have many folks who I respect, organizers, people who have been on the front lines for social change, have put their bodies where their beliefs are. And we're proud to have all of you, welcome you into KPFA Free Speech Radio on this, the 69th anniversary of the struggle to keep this station going. And we invited you all here because we know that there's a lot going on this weekend. There are protests throughout the weekend around the country and around the world. We know there's a lot happening in the Bay Area. There's a major protest planned in Oakland. And we wanted to talk generally about what is getting you out now, why you feel it's important for people to get out, to resist, to put your bodies out there now. We want to know something about what you're thinking, what your fears are, and what your focus is. So, again, thank you for coming. Thank you, Francisco Herrera, my good longtime partner and brother Miguel Gavilan Molina is here next to me, and that's always really a major encouragement. So Miguel and I believe that this is, if there's anything that we should be doing on the 69th anniversary of this radio network, it's opening these airwaves and letting people speak and seeing what is on your mind. Yeah. So I'm going to sort of just ask and point, invite, we have a microphone up front. And I'd like people to feel free to make a nice extended statement, and we'll have a little back and forth. We'll see if we can draw out what you're doing. We'll have a dialogue. We'll do this throughout the hour. We'll take a break about 20 minutes into the show. We'll let Mike do a little pitch and a request to support the work, a request for money. This is a special fundraising. Obviously, we're always fundraising, but this is to keep this network going, and this is a special drive to get more people to be a part of this network. So we'll tell you about that later on as well. So welcome, and maybe you want to begin. I know you have to jump out. This is sort of a newfound friend activist. Some of you may know him, but please introduce yourself and tell us what you're up to. What's going on? I know that you've been involved in terms of the journalism of trying to resist World War III. Yeah. Introduce yourself.
Well, my name is Rick Sterling. I'm active with Syria Solidarity Movement, as well as Task Force on the Americas and the Oslo Peace and Justice Center. But I'm really looking forward to the rally and march this coming weekend, Sunday at 11:30. I think it couldn't be more timely and more urgent. We all know what's been going on in Washington, and it's extremely, extremely dangerous. We've got the President of the U.S. Declaring that he's going to strike hard against Syria. We've got John Bolton and other people in the administration who are talking about it's not enough to hit Syrian bases. They need to punish Russia in Iran as well. 1 month ago, the Russian chief of general staff predicted all the events. He said they had hard evidence there was going to be a fake chemical weapons incident. They predicted that fake evidence would be presented and that the U.S. would attack Syria. And he went on to say that Russian soldiers are embedded with Syrian soldiers throughout the country, and if they are attacked, Russia will respond. So it couldn't be more dangerous. Just two points about this. We know that this is not, there's nothing to do with humanitarianism coming out of the White House. What did they say about the massacre, the open massacre of Palestinians? Nothing. What have they done or said about the massacre of Yemenis by Saudi Arabia? Absolutely nothing. The U.S. is fueling the aircraft bombers. It's supplying new weapons to Saudi Arabia. So what's going on in Syria has nothing to do with humanitarianism. And the other thing we know is that an attack on Syria will prolong it and be a disaster. It'll create more civilian casualties. It'll escalate the conflict. It's absolutely the wrong thing to do, and it's we're really hovering on the edge of disaster here. So it's urgent that everybody do everything they can, and I'm really looking forward to Sunday. We need to revitalize the anti-war movement, and it's going to start on Sunday.
Hey. All right, thank you. Nice. Thank you. Again, you're listening to a special edition of Flashpoints. This is a Friday speak out in anticipation of protests taking place this weekend. We have invited a whole bunch of activists into the KPFA studio to help us celebrate this, the 69th anniversary of free speech, no holds barred, non-corporate fight back, truth to power radio. And we thought on Flashpoints, Miguel and I thought this would be the way to go. Miguel, your thoughts as looking forward, and I think you had prepared some words. We're going to keep talking, but I asked Miguel to take a poetic look at some of the stuff.
I called it some words, maybe rhymes, some prose. But I wrote this coming in thinking about a lot of things. I've been getting calls, as I mentioned to you earlier, for weeks now. People are afraid. What do we do? Do we leave the state? Do we go? Where can we hide? All of that. So I put this together today when Dennis said, hey, I want you to say something. I call it The Brown Giant Awakens. The brown giant is awake, sending la águila negra, the black eagle, al cielo, into the heavens, casting its shadow across the four directions of this country. Moonbeams penetrate la tierra, awakening a nation. Mexica rising, children of the sun, people of the corn and maize, keepers of the garden, la madre sagrada, sacred earth, agua protectors, defenders of la tierra, and freedom fighters for el pueblo. One for all or none at all. Ay, 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 ay. Wake up, America. The browning of America is here to stay. It's a new age, a new day, a new dawn, a beginning for all of us. We will not go away. Ni modo. We've been here over 20,000 years. Get used to it.
Used to it.
It's brown moon rising. A new realization that we, the brown, the proud, the resistance, are part of a new movement. Our existence is the resistance against racial hatred, bigotry, discrimination, and domination. Time for us to stand, resist. Time has come today to take the streets to the centers of power, question and challenge that authority. Time to fight back and take back this country. Si se puede, as I was told by Cesar. Adelante, hasta la muerte, aquí vamos. Ay, 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 canta y no llores. Ay, 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 el grito, the rebel yell. We will be there el domingo. Come Sunday. Ajo.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. That's the voice of Miguel Gavilan Molina. Everybody knows that voice. And Miguel is a amazing human being. We've been working together now for about 15 years since the beginning of the Brown Revolution, that first caravan of
2003.
Brown people.
Right, Freedom, Freedom Riders.
Freedom Rider went all the way across country, and you, that's how you joined the show.
Right. Mike. Okay.
And that was the
they
launching.
They do not know that they are on live in this room.
That was the launching of the Brown Civil Rights Movement.
Mm-hmm.
Because when brown people are attacked, it just isn't the undocumented. You know, I can't tell you how many times I have been stopped and asked for my papers. I give them my license, and they want to see documents. Are you crazy? I'm a citizen. I was born here. But that's the reality. So until you have to deal with that, that's why in 2003 I came on board. The first thing I told Dennis, I go, hey, in 2 weeks I've been invited to go across the country on the Freedom Riders. It was the reenactment of Martin Luther King's Freedom Riders to Selma. And, well, I joined that effort. It was sponsored by the AFL-CIO and the Immigrant Rights Network.
And, of course, Francisco, we the Flashpoints show considers this the cutting edge, the front line of civil rights in this country, of human rights, is the struggle for worker rights, the struggle of the undocumented worker to be treated like a human being and given a living wage.
Yeah, I was on that same bus ride from Seattle. we started the Seattle bus. I'd like to call us pre-documented. Undocumented sounds a little stale, like it's all permanent, right? Pre-documented says the reality that, you know, we're in process, we're all moving, all this always changes.
Right. Well, I stand corrected. No. Again, this is a Speak Out, a Flashpoints, and maybe Walter, you could come up, and then Richard, and we can keep a flow going. Oh, what happened to our microphone? Yeah, here we go. This is what we're going to do. Hold that thing.
Thank you. Thank you, Dennis. Thank you, and great to be here with everybody. It's a large group of folks that are building this march on Sunday. And what I'm doing is being part of the coordinating and steering committee with a bunch of folks. It's a large coalition. We are dealing with a number of issues. I'm going to read the things that we have listed on our flyer. And I need my glasses. I gave somebody my glasses, and I can't
there
see.
Well, now you got
it happens
glasses.
Like that. No to U.S. threats of war, headlining here. And we have threats that are, of course, everybody is so much aware of that is creating the tension across the world, the possibility of war, mobilizing. The U.S. is already moving its troops around, threatening. They're threatening people in the Middle East, but they're threatening people in South America and Central America. The U.S. military threatens people in Haiti, where I'm doing a lot of work. We have going to have some more discussions about what's happening in Haiti right now. But we're saying hands off Haiti, Honduras, and U.S. overt and covert wars, drone wars, and the embargoes. Close all U.S. bases, foreign and local. Bring all U.S. troops home now. Get them out of the war. Get them out of the killing zones. Bring them home back to their families. Bring them home to us where we can talk about making changes here. Bring them home to us where we can talk about having people go to other places and do something useful. Defend this environment. Our role in this on this earth can be diminishing tremendously. So many of the species have been completely annihilated. We don't want to be annihilated as human beings because of capital, because of profit, because of power in the hands of a few people. No to white supremacy, which is a driving force that keeps a lot of folks in power here, keeps a lot of divisions, and keeps people from coming together to fight our main enemy, corporate greed, international threats. No human being is illegal. Clear part of the movement that we've been part of for so long. So many of us stop the deportations and the treatment of DACA and protective status attacks. And we want an early path to citizenship. These are parts of our demands. No to sexism. No to the myopia of people who want to maintain tremendous power in their own hands in small groups, the racism, the sexism, the targets against individuals. We need money for human needs. Stop the wars. Money for human needs right here in the U.S. This is the driving force of the coalition. This is why it's come together here in the Bay Area. This is part of what it is across the country.
Thank you. And Walter, like, in terms of if people want to know more about, specifically about the work that you do with Haiti, what's the best way to do that?
The best way to do that is to get to the Haiti Emergency Relief Fund, which is what I chair, and to Haiti Action Committee, .org. Go to the Internet for that. That work is extremely important. What we do to Haiti right now in the U.S., what we do as a movement for Haiti, I think helps us to understand and informs us about how we treat each other here and how we treat the people of the world. Haiti is a microcosm of what we're doing for the exportation of people all over. We have to end it. We have to take control of it right here on our own soil.
All right. Walter Riley, a longtime activist, extraordinary work. And later on, we're going to hear from a very patient Pierre Labossiere. We have a bunch of people here at this special speak out. This is the 69th birthday celebration of free speech, KPFA Pacifica Radio. We believe in free speech radio now more than ever. This non-corporate university, really, this invisible university in the airwaves, it's more important. You all know it's more important now than ever because we have the opportunity and the possibility to do this kind of spontaneous speak out as a part of what we're calling our birthday celebration. And do remember that we need your support. I hope Mike is in there listening because after our next speakers, we're going to take a break and we're going to tell you more specifically how you can join us today for this birthday celebration. We'll take a break here, but first, Davey, welcome to the table.
It's good to be here.
Well, you know, this is going to be an anti-war weekend. What are you thinking about? Or what are you going to bring to the weekend?
I think it's important that there's an anti-war weekend. It's been a long time coming. I think people need something that is very dramatic in terms of how it sounds and how it looks and is very efficient in terms of how it can execute and inspire people to move in a particular direction. What's been dominating, I think, the mainstream narrative, and I'm saying this as a professor who teaches on the campus and just seeing the type of conversations that people have, there's too much air taken out by the current administration and their antics. The things that they're doing, the negativity seems to cloud, I think, many people's imaginations, if I could say so. We're hearing about dude doing this, and he's going to build a wall over here, and he's going to bomb, and it's going to be this. And what we're not having and what we're not seeing enough of is, you know, big group of people that you have assembled here who are, you know, gung-ho and dead set to really re-anchor themselves and take a front stage position in terms of this fight. I just think there's been too much acquiescing from many people who are in positions of power, and it's sad to see. So I think this weekend is much needed. It's going to be a breath of fresh air and hopefully something that we can follow up on.
Phoebe, you want to jump in here?
Introduce yourself. Okay, hi. Am I on?
You're sitting here and what you're going to be doing this weekend.
I'm Phoebe Thomas Sorgan, and I've gotten four organizations to endorse the actions on Sunday. The Green Party for People, Planet, Peace, the Move to Amend Coalition, Standing Up to Corporate Personhood, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, and the legendary Berkeley Fellowship of UUs. So we all endorsed because there's nothing more important now than ending the U.S. wars at home and abroad. And it coincides with Tax Day. You know, 60% of our taxes are going to the military. And when you think of what we could do with that money, instead of waging war on seven nations, and how many of you can name those seven nations? KPFA listeners probably can, but most people can't. And of course, we're aggressing so many other nations. And all that money, instead, we could fund free quality education, housing and health care for all, reparations for past wrongs, transition to a sustainable energy economy and away from fossil fuels. So let's not be fools. Everybody come out there on Sunday, fight for peace, fight for justice. It's really important. And what else more important is there in the world to do?
Beautiful. Thank you. Thank you. And again, you're listening to KPFA Flashpoints Pacifica Radio. Come on up, join us. David, did you want to say respond? Or I think you maybe...
I think what she just said, you know, just with those endorsements, you could feel that energy. It's like the mindset of somebody listening would be like, well, wait a second, why is my name not on that list to endorse? You know, how do I become a part of that? I think we just have to keep that sort of momentum going. I think it's critically important because people don't see it and hear it enough, even though I think we all respectively organize and build in our communities. I think we have to be bold and be like, nah, this is what we're doing on Sunday. We're going to broadcast live. Yeah. You're going to see all these people. We're coming out for a reason. It's not to just be on TV, but it's really to bring that energy to the people and let them know that they're not alone.
And that's today's song of the week, actually.
A whole bunch of us are going to be out there on Sunday. We're going to be with the microphones. We'll have the table set up. We'll be there. We'll be taking notes, and we'll want to hear what everybody's saying and being able to pass that along next week. Again, that's part of the work we do as the electronic leaflet, as the microphone for the community. A troubled community within our community is certainly the Palestinian community, given what's been going on over the last couple of weeks, the slaughters in Gaza. Norm, maybe why don't you talk to us a little bit. Tell us who you are and maybe what you're going to be doing this weekend and why.
Okay, great. Hi, everyone. My name is Nora Khoury, and I am here. I'm just really excited to see this coalition come together. Over the last 8 years prior to Trump, the wars were raging on. Income inequality was growing at record levels. Mass incarceration has been growing. Immigration has been under attack. More deportation under Obama than, under Bush. So these attacks have not stopped. They're coming even faster and more furious currently. So just really heartening to see all the groups coming together and fighting all of this. As Palestinians, we're coming up on 70 years since the Nakba here in May, where, Palestinians lost their homeland in Gaza. The situation is more dire than ever. People are more desperate. In almost over 10 years now, the siege has imprisoned Palestinians in Gaza without access to food, cement. There's been massacre after massacre. They're not allowed to rebuild. UNRWA, the food aid is being cut. It's really dire. So folks have come together to organize and have on March 30th, Land Day, Palestinians came together in Gaza to start the Great Freedom March. So over 30,000 came together weekly since then. Every Friday, they've been coming out to nonviolently protest and stand up for their rights. They've been met with vicious live fire, massacred, teachers, journalists, children, everyone is at risk, but they continue because this is such a symbolic attempt to return home. They're just trying to the issue of Palestinian right of return is the most important issue for Palestine, and this year we're asserting our rights. You know, we're calling on the community to come forward and stand up, you know, support the call. You know, boycott, divestment, and sanctions is growing stronger than ever today. We're looking at an arms embargo to limit the weapons, $3 billion every year that goes to Israel. So this coalition has stood strong against that that money, that funding that could be going to our communities and instead is going to fund weapons and slaughter of civilians. We're just calling on the international community to come to together, overcome our differences, you know, and you know, really, really asking you to come out this Sunday. This is such a critical time to bring forward our demands. You know, call Congress. You know, we have a lot of power when we all reach out with the same message. So really, please give all your Congress members a call and tell them to end U.S. funding to Israel today.
Thank you.
You won't believe what I heard. You won't believe it. War is not the answer anymore. It never was. You won't believe what I heard. You might believe it. We don't have to cultivate our lives for war. Companies now have budgets that put people first. Working folks are making tools to listen to the earth. You won't believe what I heard, but it might be true. People work now for the common good. You won't believe what I heard. You won't believe it. No one is enlisting for the wars. We got together and decided not to do it. Just like the guy who dreamt it once before. Gardens are now growing where there once were guns and tanks. Bees are pollinating where the flowers have come back. You won't believe what I heard, but it might be true. People work now for the common good. There's the punchline, people. People work now for the common good, yeah. You won't believe what I heard. You won't believe it. The working class are now becoming one. We realized war was just a rich man's racket. They made billions while we filled their body bags. Where there were schools for torture, people now work out. Families have time to play and sickness has stepped out. You won't believe what I heard, but it might be true. Here we go. People work now for the common good. You won't believe what I heard. You won't believe it. We all left the profiteers behind. Once the 99% decided not to kill, corporations simply could no longer steal. Instead of taxes for the wars, we're funding schools and parks, science, libraries, and sports, arts, and poli-sci, my major. We organized our neighborhoods and lost our fear. War's profit margin disappeared. You won't believe what I heard, but we can make it true. People work now for the common good. People work now for the common good. Yeah, yeah. People work now for the common good. Good. We'll be singing that on Sunday.
You definitely know we're live here celebrating KPFA Pacifica's 69th birthday. This is a speak out, an anti-war speak out. There's a lot of activities happening in the Bay Area, really, and around the country. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Miguel Davila Molina is here. And I just have to do this because now I'm starting to feel, like, so way guilty. In a few minutes, we are Mike, going to break and tell people how they can support and what beautiful, incredible things they can get to cover almost every part of their body and help support KPFA. But we have so much work to do, and we have a lot of stories to tell. Dick Becker's at the microphone, a longtime activist, Answer Coalition, somebody who really has consistently resisted an expanding, a never-ending expanding military out-of-control industrial complex. Put the media in there, too, now.
Thanks a lot, Dennis and Miguel, Francisco. I usually don't sing in groups of less than 100. So I wasn't singing too loudly there. You know, there can't be a war without the war propaganda, without the war hysteria. And, you know, if you talk about the Spanish-American War and remember the Maine or the Gulf of Tonkin or the weapons of mass destruction or in Libya, you know, the Viagra-fueled troops who are going to engage in mass rape and murder. And all of those stories were only useful and only effective because the mainstream media projected them, all of the mainstream media. Liberal, conservative, centrist, they all did it. So I think that's another reason why we really should salute KPFA today on its 69th birthday. And I don't remember the Spanish-American War, but I do remember those other ones, starting with the Gulf of Tonkin and how the population gets so consumed by it because it's coming at them from all different directions. And what really causes that to break down is not that the mainstream media changes or gets reformed. It's that people go into the streets and fight back. It's because of the struggle that brings about that kind of a change. And I think that's what makes what's happening this weekend so important. So I know that right now there are more and more and more demonstrations taking place, dozens now across the country, and people are coming out. And it's very, very important for all the listeners of KPFA, I mean, to know that it is the struggle, and it is the struggle in the streets that makes the difference for people to come to Lake Merritt Amphitheater to assemble at 11 o'clock on Sunday and then to march to Oscar Grant Plaza, and there'll be rallies at each end. And it really is. I don't think there's anything more important than anyone who's listening can do in the next few days than that. And just a couple hours before I came here, I saw a message, a news alert from Wall Street Journal. Did people see this, the news alert? Just two paragraphs long, but it said, Trump wants a big attack. And it said that there's a fight going on inside the administration, inside the White House, between Mattis, who thinks that it's, you know, they're not ready. They don't have a real strategy and so forth. Not that he's a pacifist himself, the mad dog. But the other side wants a bigger attack than and wants something really major. And when we talk about something really major in the context of who the forces are at play here, we're talking about, I think, what Walter Riley said earlier, the threat of the end. You know, we don't want to be overly dramatic, but we're not being overly dramatic. The escalation ladder can be climbed in such a way that even if no one at the beginning wants the most catastrophic outcome at the end, it can happen. You know, 100 years ago, a little over 100 years ago, I don't think people in Europe in July of 1914 had any idea what was coming. And so we have to stop that. And the last thing I want to say is this, is that in September of 2013, I expected to wake up on a Saturday morning. We were going to have a demonstration against a new war in Syria. I expected to hear that the bombs were falling. And instead, Obama had to pull back. And he had to pull back really more than anything because of the worldwide sentiment against the new war. We have to do what we can, and we have to do that now. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you. Thank you. You are, again, listening to Flashpoints, KPFA. Happy birthday, KPFA, 69th birthday. What a gift. Everybody here has to agree it's an amazing gift to have these powerful microphones, these microphones that stretch all the way up the coast of California down to Santa Cruz. We You know, this is one of the most, if not the most powerful FM radio signal in Northern and Central California. This is a very valuable, incredible thing we have. And, wow, we get to share it and fight for it. And, boy, it is a fight. I want to tell you that we are asking folks to support the work we do here. I just want to take 30 seconds to tell you that you can sort of cover your almost your entire body. You can get a T-shirt for $65, a hoodie for $100, a cap for $80, socks for $60, a water bottle for $75, and the tote bag for $100. You can get all those things. You can get the movie about KPFA, which... I play a dramatic role. My role is only about 17 seconds. You hear me at when the film opens. You'll hear somebody screaming. Hey, put your guns back in your holsters. That was me telling the folks who had been hired, former FBI CIA agents, to take over, lock down this station. That's how powerful we are. We want to be able to keep doing this work, keep having these teach-ins, these speak-outs. This is a fight. So please keep me out of trouble. Am I supposed to tell them the phone number?
How much for the movies?
How much for the movies? Walter's
the movies.
Asking.
The movies. You can get for $100 contribution. You can get the KPFA on the air. You can, again... $100 contribution. It's a film by Veronica Selva. You can get the T-shirt, the hoodie, the cap, the socks, the whatever. And what's the number here, Frank?
Do we remember? It's 1-800-439-5732.
Well, we all know the number. 1-800-439-5732. 1-800-439-5732. Can we all do a group number?
Yeah, let's do 1-800-439-5732.
5732. This is Free Speech Radio. This is the People's Radio Network. We need you to help us keep going. We've got Free Will and Frank at the mic. I'm going to ask him to extend his biography, tell us about what you're going to be doing this weekend. And then Pierre, prepare to come up here and do some damage. Please sit up here Francisco, we're going to come back to you because after people hear these folks, they're going to need a song.
Yeah. How y'all doing? I came to, there's a lot going on, and this is about Sunday, or this is about the event, but it's in a different manner because I've been here now coming up on 15 years at KPFA, and if you all know me, I've been a fighter for community events and for not just coverage in the news, but support in the lead up to the events. We can make a concerted effort like we did today for KPFA's birthday to pay our bills and to keep the lights on, as they say. We should be able to make a concerted effort as a unit, as a station, to bring these events, this anti-war march, the March for Climate Leadership, Block the Boat, whatever the event is, KPFA and other public radio stations should play a big part in the lead up to the events. And a way we could do that is by having familiar programmers, regular daily programmers, picking an organization that's one of the coalition and interviewing them in the weeks leading up to the event. And we make concerted efforts to pay our bills and to pay ourselves. We should make a concerted effort to make these events not just what they can be by handing out flyers, but with our broadcasting. And it really irks me that we have not done this in this event or in other events in the past. And we have fought for it many, many times. And I walked into the phone room today with one of these flyers, and I said, who's going to this on Sunday? And know what they said? Going to what?
Oh.
These are people that listen to KPFA every day. I'm just going to say it. We have let us down. KPFA has let us down on this. And we need to lead these events with lead up in the weeks ahead with a concerted effort like we do to keep the lights on. We should support KPFA. We need to support KPFA. But KPFA needs to do a little bit better for us. And we need to bring these events. You guys know what I'm saying.
You heard it from
Frank.
We
need to support these events, not just cover them in the news. We need to make them as big as they could possibly be. One great example is what happened on, I think it was May Day in Los Angeles, when there was thousands of people out there. Thousands. And you can credit that to radio, community radio in that area, who broadcasted. Everybody was on the same message. So why aren't we doing that? with KPU, with KL, whatever it is over there in San Francisco. All these other ones.
I don't think I would disagree with a single syllable.
That's my fight, and I'm going to continue that fight at KPFA, and we should be doing that. I got to go to the backup series.
I said thank you. Thank you, Frank. Dennis so,
thank you all. I'm out of here. We'll be on 7, full circle.
All right, sir.
Again, you're listening. This is a speak out, so that's what Frank's speaking out, and we appreciate that. A good friend, maybe Pierre, I could ask you to step up to the mic, because that's a beautiful mic we have for you there.
Wonderful.
And get in nice and close, and introduce yourself. Tell us what brings you here, what you'll be doing this weekend. And Miguel's going to make sure that thing sounds terrific.
Thank you, Miguel.
Come on in.
Okay.
That screen needs to
very
be
very close to the mic.
Right in there.
Thank you very much. Okay. Does that work now? Yeah. Really excited to be part of the Speak Out and calling on everyone, the listening community, to be out there at Lake Merritt Amphitheater, 11 a.m. on Sunday, April 15th. And also, there will be a march at it will, and then another rally at 1:30 at Frank Ogawa Plaza and Oscar Grant Plaza. And this is very, very important. And I want to raise the name of Kilu Niasha, our dearly beloved sister, who passed away in her sleep on Tuesday. And so I know she always says we need to connect the dots.
Yes.
And this is exactly what this coalition is about. It's connecting the dots against imperialism, standing up for people's rights, standing up so that the money, the wealth that people produce is used to provide services for people, is used for education. I just came back. I was with Walter Riley. We were in Haiti with a delegation. And so the power of radio. This is something that's very important. There is a radio station, Radio Timoun, Youth Radio, in Haiti, which they are trying to keep it under wraps. Most of the other radio stations that cover the country of Haiti are owned by the elite. They receive a lot of advertising money from the various embassies, the U.S., the French embassy, the European Union, and what have you. They pour big money into that so that and Radio Timoun does not cover the country. But they know that by keeping the communication limited, that they can do all kinds of damage to the people's movement. And so things that people need to be aware of, such as the corruption, the monies that were given to Haiti by generous people all over the world, those billions of dollars never reached the population. Monies from Petrocaribe were stolen, $3.8 billion stolen by the Haitian government and others associated with it. People are protesting in the streets. Students... There have been so many students in the streets of Haiti, teachers not getting paid. Now, I'm talking about Haiti, but I know what I'm saying could be people from Puerto Rico can relate. People from Central America can relate. People from Africa, from the various African nations can relate to this. And people right here in our community can relate to that in the various communities in the U.S. So it's important that we have communication, that we share with each other what's going on. In Haiti, the radio is active in doing what is called mental decolonization. Colonization, they call it the New World Order nowadays, but it's really the same old colonialism, the colonization of the mind. And in Haiti, that radio station is very powerful, and they are trying to expand to reach a broader audience. So I'm raising these points because those are what's in the demands here that is being made that has brought this coalition together. So it's important that we all come together on Sunday and form this connecting the dots, as Kilu Niasha would be saying. So also, I just want to say that this weekend is a weekend of various activities. We need to be in the streets, support, be part of these activities, and really send a very loud message that we stand for humanity. We stand for each other. No to war, no to imperialism, no to exploitation, no to sexism, no to racism. And we are going to have poetry.
He's going to be out in the streets on Sunday.
Poetry for Peace and Justice is happening on Saturday from 3 to 5. And we are dedicating this to Kilu Niasha as well, to her memory, our powerful fighter.
Yeah. the panther who flew when she couldn't walk anymore. Jeff, why don't you come on up here? We have a very we have a lot to cover. Have a seat here. Now we're going to have to go very quickly through all this. But I wanted to get my friend here, who I'm just meeting, David, for the first time, because David was busy doing something. He was busy doing something very important. I want to say this again. He was doing something very important this morning, because there's a ongoing slaughter going on in the Gaza Strip, and not much is being said about it. And I think, well, what did you do? What was the action this morning? Could you describe us, say something about the group and what you did?
Sure. I'm really excited to be a part of this. I'm really excited to be here with KPFA. Again, my name's David. I'm here with If Not Now. We're a group of American Jews working to end the American Jewish community support for the Israeli occupation of Palestine. And today, about 20 of us blocked the entrance to Senator Dianne Feinstein's office in downtown San Francisco, calling on her to condemn the violence that the Israeli military has been visiting upon Palestinian protesters. 9 young Jews ended up getting arrested. It was clear that Senator Feinstein in that moment chose to remove us from the scene rather than listening to what we were saying. But just an hour later, the senator tweeted out a statement condemning the violence in Gaza.
Which is a victory, because, boy, she's been quite a violent senator. She talks about gun control here in domestic America, but she is like the number one arms salesman in the world, or one of them.
Her statement was a little bit equivocal and left something to be desired. It was a little bit violence on both sides, but we saw it definitely as a victory. We saw it as something that would never have happened if we as Jews hadn't asked her to take a stand on this. And we see it as representative of a change in the climate for American Jews.
How many people were arrested?
9 people, as well as one of the legal observers.
One of the observers.
Yes.
And did they just write you up and release you?
Yes.
Okay. And I assume this isn't the last of this kind of action in terms of the U.S. policy and support for Israeli policy. I imagine, this is essentially the millennials. Who are you with? Who did you do this with today?
Today, all of us who are taking action, just to clarify, I wasn't personally arrested. I was in a support role. But today, those of us who were taking action were primarily young Jews. It's a movement primarily of young people, but we plan and we trust that in time, it's going to be a movement of everybody in the American Jewish community speaking out on this issue.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. We appreciate that. You are listening to a special Speak Out on Flashpoints. We're celebrating the 69th birthday of Pacifica. Pacifica is only 2 months older than me. Oh, my God. We're both getting old, but we're going to continue. Anyway, we have to get a couple more folks in, and we're running out of time. Why don't you jump up here, switch seats here, while I turn to somebody who knows everything about what's going to happen on Sunday. Jeff, why don't you, should I give him this mic here? Yeah. Why don't you just tell us about what's happening and how hard you've been working for the last million hours to make what's happening happen this Sunday?
Well, first, I've been working as part of a team. We have something like 600 organizations across the country who are building April 14th and 15th. In the Bay Area, we have an unprecedented 120 groups. Every peace and justice group, anti-racist group, political group, socialist group, liberal group, they're all joining hands to build April 15th, Sunday, at Frank Ogawa Plaza. The main rally is going to be at 1:30. We assemble and have another rally at Lake Merritt Amphitheater and a mile march. What's unprecedented about this rally is that it's the first in modern history where the movement has come together to challenge the wars at home and abroad. This is not just an anti-war demonstration for foreign countries. The United States has troops and missile bases in 1,100 bases in 120 countries around the world, whereas the aggressor, China, has one in the whole world. And the Russians, the aggressor, has maybe two outside its own borders. We are on the eve, if these insane people in Washington have their way, for a major war that could be a shooting war, as Pierre and others said, that could end it all. The only thing we have on our side is that we represent the aspirations and hopes of the American people. We represent the majority. They don't want wars. They're against racism and poverty and pension cutting and the Janus decision and union busting. This demonstration is a first, and it is not only opposed to the war at home, the threatened war and intervention against Venezuela. It's the first united demonstration that demands an end to all U.S. aid to apartheid Israel, which is an amazing basis for unity and a necessary basis.
What are you asking people to do?
We're asking everyone to mobilize, bring their friends, pass out leaflets. You can contact us at social. Spring Action 2018 at lmi.net, and we'll get the leaflets to you. Bring your friends. Join the action. We have Alice Walker speaking. We have Cindy Sheehan speaking. That's Pulitzer Prize winner Alice Walker. We have the endorsement of the Alameda Labor Council that represents 100,000 workers. The San Francisco Labor Council has passed on that endorsement. We have the labor movement mobilizing, we hope, to join us and have a united movement to bring all the troops home now.
Thank you, Jeff, for the incredibly hard work. We have a few more people we want to get in. We have somebody from Hoback. What is Hoback? Tell us who you are.
Yeah, for sure.
What you're doing here.
So my name is Simon. It's nice to see everyone here at Speak Out. And I'm here representing Hobak, or Hello Organized Bay Area Koreans. We're a community of radical anti-imperialist Koreans living in the Bay Area. And when thinking about an action to end all wars, I think it's important to note that many of us as radical Bay Area Koreans are living here in diaspora because of the direct impact of U.S. imperialism and because of the direct impact of militarization in our ancestral homeland of Korea. So Hobak members are rolling out. We're mobilizing to join the action to end all wars at home and abroad so that we can continue building on this anti-war movement to end the legacies of war and trauma in our communities. I think it's important to note that the war between North Korea and the U.S. isn't over. Only an armistice was signed, and a peace treaty was never signed. During the Korean War in the 1950s, the U.S. dropped over 635,000 tons of bombs, raising over 90% of the country, killing over 3 million civilians. And my parents were born in 1952, and our lives have been directly impacted by this legacy of war and trauma in Korea. The other thing I want to point out is that while there are steps being taken between the governments to facilitate peace and denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, both from North Korea and the U.S., that true reunification necessitates, it needs grassroots mobilization and people, directly affected people, coming together to engage in the deep healing work that needs to be done, that is necessary because of the trauma and violence. So if y'all are living in the Bay Area and are Korean and are interested in joining us in this deep healing work to build a sustainable movement against wars and imperialism, please contact us at Bay Area Koreans on Twitter or on Facebook, and we look forward to meeting with you and engaging with y'all.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. All right. We have our next guest is a part of this radio station, part of this celebration. Let me ask you to introduce yourself and tell us what you're doing here.
I'm glad
that you should be here.
Yes, I'm Vilma V, and I'm here as an activist, a Puerto Rican activist. And speaking of the late activist, she connected the dots. We have to continue to connect the dots. We know that all this money diverts away from social programs, from health care, from the climate change that we have to deal with. So I think it's really important that people show up, and this begins the larger resistance that includes all of us. There's a lot happening in Puerto Rico. I hope that people take a look at what's going on with the increased colonization, the control board, lots of things going on. And I'm very gratified to see people here, and I'm going to see you at Lake Merritt on Sunday. Thank you, Dennis, Miguel Molina, for making this happen. Francisco, Frank, let's keep making this radio station something that we can all get behind. And happy birthday, KPFA.
And thank you for all the amazing programming you've done and all the people you've helped do great stuff. You've really made a contribution.
And I'll just give the phone number because we are trying to raise funds. 1-800-439-5732. Go to KPFA.org. Or 1-800-HEY-KPFA. We really need your support. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right. We just have a minute and a minute. Mm-hmm. So introduce yourself. Tell us what you're doing here.
Hi, I'm Tova, and I'm from the International Action Center. And what I really wanted to point out is that when we talk about ending the wars at home and abroad, people might wonder, what kind of war are we talking about at home? We're talking about fighting white supremacy. We're talking about the war against immigrant rights. You know, we're talking about the war against black and brown people in this country. And it's really important that we connect these dots. And when you come out on Sunday, this coming Sunday, April 15th, at 11 a.m. at Lake Merritt Amphitheater, and march with us after we rally there to Oscar Grant Plaza, where we're going to rally again. We're connecting all these dots, as Pierre talked about, and we want to talk about Stephon Clark and Salim Tyndall and the people who have been killed in the streets of this city and this state, and a DA that we have locally, DA Nancy O'Malley, who has never prosecuted a single killer cop, and we're going after the police officer's Bill of Rights. So there's a lot of things going on related to the war at home that need to be shared as
Thank
well.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. 30 seconds for our good old friend.
Okay. So 30 seconds. So I'm Judy Greenspan. I'm here representing Workers' World Party. But I really wanted to talk because I'm an Oakland public school teacher. I work in a really very poor neighborhood. And I want to do a shout out to people in Oakland to tell you that there are so many reasons why we need to be present on Sunday at 11 o'clock at Lake Merritt Amphitheater, and then to march over to Oscar Grant Plaza. We have the fight against gentrification. We have the fight against homelessness. We have the fight against hunger. We have the fight to maintain and save public schools in our city. And I'll tell you something. Teachers are not going to be carrying guns. Teachers are going to be defending. Oh, yeah. We are going to be defending the undocumented, the pre-documented, and we are going to be fighting against racism and all of the Thank oppression you. In the city.
Like yes, we said, this is a speak out. Lean into the microphone and very quickly.
Yes. I'm Eleanor Levine from Code Pink Women for Peace, which is a long-standing anti-war organization. Time is short, so I just want to say two things. One is that it's historic that we are talking about war and militarization at home and abroad. If we don't unite, we cannot defeat the system that we live under, the war economy. We need to build a peace economy. And the last thing I want to say is, after you come out on Sunday, I know you're coming out on Sunday, that's just the first step. After Sunday, we would love to have you join any of the organizations that are out there. Get involved, because that's what's going to make a change. You can get involved in Code Pink's anti-drone movement. You can get involved in Stop Urban Shield. You can get involved in the immigrant rights organizations, and so on and so forth. But this is your first step. Come on and join us.
Wow, what a privilege to be here. KPFA, it's the Flashpoint Show, is Speak Out, anti-war Speak Out, leading into this weekend. A lot of people are going to be out in the streets in Oakland and other parts of the state and the country. I'm honored to be here with my friend Miguel Gavilan Molina. Can we hear it from Miguel? And our resident troubadour for Flashpoints, Francisco Herrera. Francisco, can you go out with me? We have time to do the children's song. Can we go out with that?
Do we have time?
Yes, go.
Our children are sacred. Nuestros niños son sagrados. Our children are beautiful. Bellos son. Our children are gifts. Son el regalo más amado. Our our children are sacred. Sagrados son children. Our children are sacred. Nuestros niños son sagrados. Our children are beautiful. Bellas son. Our children are gifts. Son el regalo más amado. Our children are sacred. Sagrados son. Our children are sacred. Sagradas son. Our children are sacred. Sagrados son. Our children are sacred. Sagrados son.
We're out of here.
And people work out for the coming good.
Last time.
People work out for the coming good.
Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Noam Chomsky, David Rovics, I, and, of all people, Thomas Friedman, talk about energy and the environment. There's some good news and some bad news, and I hope you'll stay tuned. It's been a while since we devoted a show to energy and the environment. Some nice, juicy current events are impossible to resist, though. Some of the news is good, sort of. And, of course, when it comes to the environment, much of the news is bad. Nuclear energy, nuclear bombs, coal, and the destruction of the environment and its creatures are all closely interconnected. And, if the gods permit, we shall hear more from David Rovics, Noam Chomsky, I, and others. Let's start off with some good news about nuclear electricity. In April 2015, an installment of New World Notes was titled Bad Business, Nuclear Power. There, two distinguished commentators argued that nuclear power was not economically viable, never was economically viable, and never will be economically viable. So said both Jeremy Rifkin, the famous management consultant, and David Freeman, a highly experienced power systems administrator. Both men agreed that nuclear power is alive only because the federal government keeps it alive with billions of our tax dollars. The federal government keeps this industry alive for two reasons. One, to keep some big businesses profitable. The other reason, nuclear power is a public fig leaf for the military's nuclear bomb-making program. There are dozens of good arguments against nuclear power. Here's a bunch. Nuclear energy is a massive source of hydrocarbon emissions, when you include the mining and refining of their uranium fuel. Nuclear plants also emit deadly, lethal waste, even when operating normally. And, of course, much more when they explode. There is no good way to store the deadly waste products these plants generate. Jeremy Rifkin brought up an idea that was new to me. There is not enough fresh water in the world to cool any large number of nuclear plants. But in America, where money talks, how's this argument? Every other way of generating electricity is cheaper than nuclear. Coal and oil have always cost less than nuclear. Solar is now at that point, and probably wind too. Maybe fat cats, who don't care about destroying life on Earth, might be moved at least by this argument. In any semblance of a free market, there's no way you can make a profit on nuclear. Anyway, that was a pretty nice old show of ours. You can grab a copy of it on our website if you're so inclined. Look for New World Notes number 373, Bad Business, Nuclear Power, from April 2015. You can find our website at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. But back to the present. Just to prove Jeremy Rifkin and David Friedman were right about the economics, here's part of a story from the New York Times, March 30th, 2017. Bankruptcy rocks nuclear industry. And I quote, Westinghouse Electric Company, which helped drive the development of nuclear energy and the electric grid itself, filed for bankruptcy protection on Wednesday, casting a shadow over the global nuclear industry. The filing comes as the company's corporate parent, Toshiba of Japan, scrambles to stanch huge losses stemming from Westinghouse's troubled nuclear construction projects in the American South. Now the future of these projects, which once seemed to be on the leading edge of a renaissance for nuclear energy, is in doubt. Westinghouse, once a proud name that in years past symbolized America's supremacy in nuclear power, now illustrates its problems. Continuing with the story, slowing demand for electricity and tumbling prices for natural gas have eroded the economic rationale for nuclear power, which is extremely costly and technically challenging to develop. Alternative energy sources like wind and solar power are rapidly maturing and coming down in price. The 2011 earthquake in Japan that led to the nuclear disaster at the Fukushima Daiichi plant renewed worries about safety. Westinghouse's problems are already reducing Japan's footprint in nuclear power, an industry it has nurtured for decades in the name of energy security. General Electric, a pioneer in the field, also has scaled back its nuclear operations, expressing doubts about their economic viability. Areva, the French builder, is mired in losses and undergoing a large-scale restructuring. Okay, end of text. Ken speaking again now. Further proof of what you heard here 2 years ago. Nuclear power is not going to work economically, just as it doesn't work in a dozen other aspects. Nuclear power is an environmental disaster and a threat to world peace. That will get you a shrug from any capitalist. But, again, the good news, nuclear power is now, obviously, an economic disaster. And real shareholders are losing real money on this turkey. That's bad news for big power, hence good news for Earth. I confess I do feel a bit of ambivalence here. For one, some innocent people have some pension funds caught up in Westinghouse and Toshiba. Also, my own father worked for Westinghouse in a blue-collar job most of his life. In Westinghouse's home appliance division, not the nuclear division. I remember when Westinghouse was a grand old company, not a bankrupt subsidiary of Toshiba. It was a blue-chip company, so-called, up there with the Pennsylvania Railroad, Polaroid, Chrysler Corporation, International Business Machines, and Transworld Airlines. How the mighty have fallen, eh? What do we have now in place of industrial giants like Westinghouse and the Pennsylvania Railroad? Do you say with pride, well, we're the country that built Snapchat and Disney Studios? Sorry, to me it just isn't the same. But enough of nostalgia. Let's turn from nuclear to coal, and let's start with a song by David Rovix. I haven't been able to track down the news story on which this song is based. A Tennessee citizen attacks a coal mine. Rovix wrote, true story, but I had to make up some of the details since the culprit never got caught. Here we go.
I grew up on this mountain, came back here to dwell. Maybe have a family, plant some corn and dig a well. I was all done with the army, back from Vietnam, where I learned how to hold a rifle and how to set a bomb. I grew up on this mountain, it's in my very soul. So when the company moved next door, started digging for the coal, tearing up the with drillers and drag lines, I knew then what needed to happen to those mines. 10, 9, 8, sometimes that's just how it goes. 3, 2, 1, get out before it blows. Ground stayed well out of sight. I tied sticks to the equipment, set the timer on, and I knew that in 10 seconds those dozers would be gone. 10, 9, 8, sometimes that's just how it goes. 3, 2, 1, get out before it blows. And I figured I did my small part to make the world free. In my humble manner in East Tennessee. 10, 9, 8, sometimes that's just how it goes. 3, 2, 1, get out before it blows.
So, some more on coal. The good news here, too. Like nuclear plants, coal-fired plants are closing down, and nothing President Trump can do could halt the rapid decline of this industry either. Here's part of a recent column by Thomas Friedman in the New York Times, April 19, 2017. Yes, that Thomas Friedman, that mouthpiece of neoliberal capitalist values. But again, if even the capitalists are turning against coal, that's good news for us all. The piece is titled, Coal Museum Sees Future, Trump Doesn't. Friedman writes, did you catch this gem on CNN.com from April 6? Quote, the Kentucky Coal Mining Museum in Benham, owned by Southeast Kentucky Community and Technical College, is switching to solar power to save money. Communications Director Brandon Robinson told CNN affiliate WYMT that the project, quote, will save at least $8,000 to $10,000 off the energy costs of this building alone, unquote. Friedman continues, go figure. The coal mining museum is going solar for solid economic reasons, and President Trump is reviving coal with no economic logic at all. This bizarre contrast speaks to a deeper question of leadership and how we judge presidents. Trump took two major national security decisions in the past week. One was to strike Syria. The other decision you didn't see It was Trump dismantling budgets and regulations undergirding U.S. climate and environmental protection policies in his nutty effort to revive U.S. coal-fired energy, while quietly announcing plans to withhold a promised $32.5 million U.S. contribution to the UN Population Fund, which supports family planning and maternal health. Unlike the Syria decision, Trump made the second move without seeking a comprehensive briefing from experts. He controls the world's greatest collection of climate scientists at NASA, NOAA, the EPA, the Pentagon, and the CIA. And without ever asking for an intelligence briefing on how the combination of climate change, environmental degradation, drought, and population explosion helped trigger the civil war in Syria, spawn terrorist groups like Boko Haram around Lake Chad, which has lost 90% of its water since 1963, and become the main force pushing tens of thousands of migrants from sub-Saharan Africa into Europe each year and from Central America up to the U.S. Friedman continues, I promise you that Trump will spend the rest of his presidency dealing with the disruptions caused by this cocktail of population explosion and climate environmental degradation, and his generals know it. But in today's politics, bombing is considered presidential, and ignoring science and defunding family planning, when populations are exploding and droughts expanding, these are ho-hum back page news. The Sierra Club and the Bloomberg Organization formed an environmental joint venture in 2011. They noted that then there were 514 coal-fired power plants in America. And since then, 254 of them have announced that they will shut down. They expect that fully two-thirds of the plants will be phased out by 2022, no matter what Trump says or does. Okay, sidebar comment. Let me reread those figures. In 2011, in the United States, there were 514 coal-fired power plants. Since then, 254 of them have announced they will shut down. Why? Because it's not economically viable. And nothing Trump can do will make them economically viable. Okay, thank you, Thomas Friedman. And that's a voice one doesn't hear often on New World Notes, but in fact, here he's saying something well worth listening to. Let's turn to a voice you've heard more often here, Noam Chomsky. Now, Chomsky nicely ties together all the threads of our show today. Nuclear, coal, destruction of the environment by greenhouse gases, destruction of the environment by nuclear bombs. He spoke in Cambridge, Mass, just this April 24. We'll hear part of his speech today and more of it in some upcoming shows in the near future. We'll start with Amy Goodman asking about a comment Chomsky had made, identifying the most dangerous organization in the history of the world.
The Republican Party, you said, is the most dangerous organization in world history. Can you explain?
I also said that it's an extremely outrageous statement. But the question is whether it's true. I mean, has there ever been an organization in human history that is dedicated with such a commitment to the destruction of organized human life on Earth? Not that I'm aware of, is the Republican organization, I hesitate to call it a party, committed to that overwhelmingly. There isn't even any question about it. Take a look at the last primary campaign. Plenty of publicity. Very little comment on the most significant fact. Every single candidate either denied that what is happening, namely serious move towards environmental catastrophe, or there were a couple of moderates, so-called, Jeb Bush, who said Maybe it's happening. We really don't know. But it doesn't matter because fracking is working fine, so we can get more fossil fuels. Then there was the guy who was called the adult in the room, John Kasich, the one person who said, yes, it's true, global warming's going on, but it doesn't matter. He's the governor of Ohio. In Ohio, we're going to go on using coal for energy, and we're not going to apologize for it. So that's 100% commitment to racing towards disaster. Then take a look at what's happened since. November 8th was the election. There was, as most of you know, I'm sure, a very important conference underway in Morocco, Marrakesh, Morocco, roughly 200 countries at the United Nations-sponsored conference, the goal of which was to put some specific commitments into the verbal agreements that were reached at Paris in December 2015, the preceding international conference on global warming. The Paris conference did intend to reach a verifiable treaty, but they couldn't because of the most dangerous organization in human history. The Republican Congress would not accept any commitments. So therefore, the world was left with verbal promises, but no commitments. Well, last November 8th, they were going to try to carry that forward. On November 8th, in fact, there was a report by the World Meteorological Organization, very dire analysis of the state of the environment and the likely prospects, also pointed out that we're coming perilously close to the tipping point, which was the goal. The goal of the Paris negotiations was to keep things below that, coming very close to it, and other ominous predictions. At that point, the conference pretty much stopped because the news came in about the election. And it turns out that the most powerful country in human history, the richest, most powerful, most influential, the leader of the free world, has just decided not only not to support the efforts, but actively to undermine them. So there's the whole world on one side, literally, at least trying to do something or other. Not enough, maybe, although some places are going pretty far, like Denmark, a couple of others. On the other side, in splendid isolation, is the country led by the most dangerous organization in human history, which is saying, we're not part of this. In fact, we're going to try to undermine it. We're going to maximize the use of fossil fuels, could carry us past the tipping point. We're not going to provide funding for, as committed in Paris, to developing countries that are trying to do something about the climate problems. We're going to dismantle regulations that retard the devastating impact of production of carbon dioxide and, in fact, other dangerous gases, methane, others. Okay, so the conference kind of pretty much came to a halt. It continued, but the question was, can we salvage something from this wreckage? And pretty amazingly, the countries of the world were looking for salvation to a different country, China. Here we have a world looking for salvation to China, of all places, when the United States is the wrecking machine that's threatening destruction, with all three branches of government in the hands of the most dangerous organization in human history. And I don't have to go through what's happened since, but in general, the cabinet appointments are assigned to people whose commitment and beliefs are that it's necessary to destroy everything in their department that could be of any use to human beings and wouldn't just increase profits and power. And they're doing it very systematically, one after another. EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, has been very sharply cut. Actually, the main department that's concerned with environmental issues is the Department of Energy, which also had very sharp cuts, particularly in the environment-related programs. In fact, there's even a ban on posting and publishing information and material about this. And this is not just at the national level. The Republican Party, whatever you want to call it, has been doing this at every level. So in North Carolina, a couple of years ago, where the legislature, mostly thanks to gerrymandering, is in the hands of the Republicans, they called for a study on what sea level rise might be on the North Carolina coast. And there was a serious scientific study which predicted, I'll forget how many years, not a long time, about roughly a meter rise in sea level, which could be devastating to eastern North Carolina. And the legislature did react, namely by passing legislation to ban any actions or even discussion that might have to do with climate change. Actually, the best comment of this, I wish I could quote it verbatim, was by Stephen Colbert, who said, if you have a serious problem, the way to deal with it is to legislate that it doesn't exist. Problem solved, you know. This is going on all over the country. It's not simply climate change. That's bad enough. But there's another huge specter that we're kind of trying to survive under, and that's nuclear war. That's a whole other story. Here, both the Obama administration and increasingly Trump are radically increasing that danger. The threat of the new developments is captured very effectively in the best simple monitor of the state of the world, established at the beginning of the nuclear age by the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists. I'm sure you all know about this, but the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists regularly brings together a group of scientists, political analysts, others, very serious people, to try to give some kind of estimate of what the situation of the world is. The question is, how close are we to termination of the species? And they have a clock, the doomsday clock. When it hits midnight, we're finished. End of the human species and much else. And the question every year is, how far is the minute hand from midnight? Well, a couple of years ago, I think it was 2014, the bulletin began to take that into account and moved the minute hand up to 3 minutes to midnight, where it remained last year. About a week into Trump's term, the clock was moved again to 2.5 minutes to midnight. That's the closest it's been since 1953. And that means extermination of the species is very much an open question. I don't want to say it's solely the impact of the Republican Party. Obviously, that's false. But they certainly are in the lead in openly advocating and working for destruction of the human species. I agree, that's a very outrageous statement. So I therefore simply suggest that you take a look at the facts and see if it has any merit. In my view, the facts are pretty clear.
And here we must pause. Again, we'll hear more of Chomsky's Cambridge speech soon. Many thanks to Boston Independent Media Guy Chuck Rosina for recording Chomsky's talk and making that recording available to us. And of course, thank you for listening to New World Notes. If you like, you can listen again at our website, which remains newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust saying, illegitimi non carborundum. Good night, Chet. Good night, David. Good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are. And please tune in again next week. Ciao.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake-up call.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. James Corbett of the Corbett Report has recently put together some videos on a few 9/11 suspects. Today I'm going to share two of these with you. The first one is about 9/11 suspect and former mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani. And the second one is about 9/11 suspect Philip Zelikow, who wrote the outline for the 9/11 Commission report before the commissioners had even met. So let's begin first with 9/11 suspect Rudy Giuliani. And here's James Corbett of the Corbett Report.
After stepping down as mayor of New York City, Rudy Giuliani tried to launch himself as a national political leader on the back of the single defining event of his career.
September 11th, September 11th. Terrorists or terrorism, September 11th. The flames of hell emanating from those buildings. September 11th, fallen towers of the World Trade Center. Terrorists, September 11th, 2001.
In the end, he failed miserably, with voters immediately seeing his ploy for what it was. Base political pandering.
9/11 was bad.
I agree with that.
God, I can't believe how easy this is.
But what many do not realize is that Giuliani's case is not just that of another ghoulish politician parading on the corpses of those who died on his watch for his own political gain. On the day of 9/11, while the remains of the Twin Towers and World Trade Center 7 were still smoldering, one of Mayor Giuliani's first concerns was clearing away the evidence from the crime scene.
We were able to move 120 dump trucks out of the city last night, which will give you a sense of the work that was done overnight.
It's wild out here. They just keep coming. Look. It doesn't stop. There's more. I keep thinking it's at the end, and it's not.
Despite reassurances that the rapid removal of the evidence from Ground Zero was important for emergency access, this process went far beyond merely clearing a path for rescue workers. As Eric Lawyer, founder of Firefighters for 9/11 Truth, points out, the massive operation to haul away over 1.5 million tons of debris and to sell much of the steel to Chinese firm Baosteel at discount prices was not just an overzealous approach to clearing the area, but was itself a crime.
9/11 was the greatest loss of life and property damage in U.S. fire history. This should have been the most protected, preserved, overtested, and thorough investigation of a crime scene in world history. Sadly, it was not. What was it? Well, we know from their own admission, the majority of the evidence was destroyed. I, like Richard said, 22 years of experience, I've seen a lot of crime scenes. I've never seen anything like this in my life. I was out at the site. I saw trucks leaving faster than, you know, anywhere I've ever seen, but I accepted it at the time, and for years I accepted it because it was a recovery and rescue operation, and that's normal to have something like that going. Again, we never seen anything like it, but that was expected. What I didn't know for years, what was going on behind the scenes, was that evidence was being destroyed when it was shipped off. By their own admission, Tower 7 investigation, this investigation of Tower 7 had no physical evidence. How do you investigate a crime when you've destroyed all the evidence? It doesn't make sense. They also admit that they refused to test the explosives or to test for explosives or residue of thermite. Now, this is what I'm going to go into here just real quickly, is there are national standards for an investigation. That's what all of us are asking for, an investigation that follows national standards and holds people accountable.
Needless to say, an investigation of the 9/11 crime scene following the national investigation standards has never been conducted and never will be, as Giuliani oversaw the illegal destruction of the evidence itself. To add insult to this injury, in 2003, New York City medical examiner Charles Hirsch revealed that in the mad scramble to get rid of the crime scene evidence, human remains from the World Trade Center had been left at the Freshkills landfill, where the debris was sorted and the steel was sold. In 2007, Eric Beck, a senior supervisor of the recycling facility that sifted the debris, admitted that some of those human remains ended up in a mixture that was used to pave roads and fill potholes in New York City. But as grotesque as such revelations are, they are not the most shocking part of Giuliani's 9/11 story. In the late 1990s, the mayor oversaw the creation of a state-of-the-art $13 million emergency command center to coordinate the city's disaster recovery and response efforts. Located on the 23rd floor of World Trade Center Building 7, just across Vesey Street from the Twin Towers, the center, dubbed by local press at the time as Giuliani's Bunker, included reinforced, bulletproof, and bomb-resistant walls, its own air supply and water tank, beds, showers to accommodate 30 people, and three backup generators. It could be used to monitor all of New York's emergency communications frequencies and was staffed 24 hours a day. And yet, remarkably, on the morning of 9/11, neither Mayor Giuliani nor any other city personnel or police or fire department officials were in the bunker after the Twin Tower strikes.
As I told you guys before, it was very funny. I was on my way to work, and traffic was excellent. I received a call that a small Cessna had hit the World Trade Center, and I was asked to go and man the Office of Emergency Management. Upon arriving into the OEM EOC, we noticed that everybody was gone. I saw coffee that was on the desk. Still, the smoke was still coming off the coffee. I saw half-eaten sandwiches.
And as a sidebar comment, you just heard the late Barry Jennings speaking. He died mysteriously in 2008, right before NIST released their report on the collapse of World Trade Center 7. And now back to James Corbett.
So why wasn't the mayor and the city's emergency personnel in the location that had been purpose-built for just such an event? According to Giuliani, they had been told to evacuate because they had been given a warning that the Twin Towers were going to collapse. A warning that was evidently not passed on to any of the emergency personnel that were still working in the buildings.
I went down to the scene and we set up headquarters at 75 Barclay Street, which was right there with the police commissioner, the fire commissioner, the head of emergency management. And we were operating out of there when we were told that the World Trade Center was going to collapse. And it did collapse before we could actually get out of the building. So we were trapped in the building for 10, 15 minutes and finally found an exit and got out, walked north, and took a lot of people with us.
Giuliani, in his own words, has admitted that he was warned that the World Trade Center was going to collapse. This despite the fact that there was no possible way for this to be predicted in the first hour of the unfolding disaster. Even more incredibly, despite being given this warning, no effort was made to pass it on to the police, firefighters, and other responders who were still working in and around the buildings. When precisely was this warning given, and by whom? Why, despite acting on this warning himself, did Giuliani make no effort to pass the warning on to others? Predictably, when confronted with these questions by activists during his 2008 presidential campaign, Giuliani merely smiled and denied that he had ever received such a warning.
You reported to Peter Jennings that on 9/11 that the World Trade, the towers were going to collapse, and no steel structure in history has ever collapsed due to a fire. How come the people in the buildings weren't notified, and who else knew right about this, and how do you sleep at night?
Ma'am, I didn't know that the towers were going to collapse.
He reported it to Peter Jennings.
No.
You said on Peter Jennings on ABC
and
video,
also,
you indeed said that the towers, you were notified the towers were going to collapse while you were in some, not sure exactly where you were prior to, but you said on ABC video with Peter Jennings in an interview that you were aware that towers were going to collapse in advance. We'd like to know who told you the towers were going to collapse in advance, sir, and also we'd like to know who else you told.
Well, the fact is that I didn't realize the towers would collapse. I never realized that.
So where was the mayor on 9/11? On Pier 92, which was already set up as a functional command center due to a full-scale emergency drill by FEMA that, by a remarkable coincidence, had been scheduled for the following day.
And we selected Pier 92 as our command center. And the reason Pier 92 was selected as the command center was because on the next day, on September 12th, Pier 92 was going to have a drill. It had hundreds of people here, from FEMA, from the federal government, from the state emergency management office, and they were getting ready for a drill for biochemical attack. So that was going to be the place they were going to have the drill. The equipment was already there. So we were able to establish a command center there within 3 days that was 2.5 to 3 times bigger than the command center that we had lost at 7 World Trade Center. And it was from there that the rest of the search and rescue effort was completed.
Mayor Giuliani oversaw the illegal destruction of the 9/11 crime scene and is criminally liable for the deaths of hundreds of emergency workers for not passing on prior warnings about the collapses of the Twin Towers. It is no wonder, then, that the Fire Department of New York so passionately detests Giuliani for his actions in disgracing their fallen brothers and covering up the 9/11 crime.
Rudy Giuliani has used the horrible events of September 11, 2001, to create a carefully crafted persona. But the fact is, what Rudy portrays is not a full picture of the decisions made that led, in our view, to the unnecessary deaths of our FDNY members and the attempt to stop the dignified recovery of those lost. The urban legend of America's mayor needs to be balanced by the truth.
So what is the reward for Giuliani's criminal actions on 9/11? An offer to become the head of the Department of Homeland Security in the event of a Trump presidency, of course. This is the state of American politics, and this is precisely why a true investigation of what happened on 9/11 never has and never will be conducted by the U.S. government itself.
And now you'll hear James Corbett talk about 9/11 suspect Philip Zelikow.
It took President Bush an extraordinary 441 days after 9/11 to establish a commission to investigate the events of September 11, 2001. And it was not just the case that Bush was slow in acting. He actively resisted any investigation for as long as he could, taking the extraordinary and unprecedented step of personally asking Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle to limit Congress's investigation into those events. In the end, the commission was severely underfunded, severely rushed, and, as Commission Chairman Thomas Kane later admitted,
"We think the commission in many ways was set up to fail."
But the most unmistakable sign that Bush was only interested in appointing a cover-up commission to investigate the largest attack on U.S. soil in modern history was his initial choice for commission chairman.
"Today I'm pleased to announce my choice for commission chairman, Dr. Henry Kissinger."
"Dr. Kissinger, do you have any concerns about, once the commission begins its work, if fingers point to valuable allies, say Saudi Arabia, for example, the implications, the policy implications this could have to the United States, particularly at this delicate time?"
I have been given every assurance by the president that we should go where the facts lead us."
Not even the New York Times could believe that Henry Kissinger, the consummate Washington insider, could pretend to conduct an independent fact-finding investigation into 9/11. It is tempting to wonder if the choice of Mr. Kissinger is not a clever maneuver by the White House to contain an investigation it long opposed, the Times editorialized after the announcement. Kissinger may have been prepared for such polite disagreement with his appointment, but he was not prepared to meet the 9/11 widows whose tireless efforts had forced the creation of the commission in the first place.
"Several family members approached Kissinger and requested a meeting at his office in New York. Prior to the meeting, Kristen Breitweiser conducted a thorough investigation of Kissinger's potential conflicts of interest."
"Probably much to the chagrin of some of the people in the room, Lori asked some very pointed questions. Would you have any Saudi American clients that you would like to tell us about?" and he was very uncomfortable, kind of twisting and turning on the couch. And then she asked whether he had any clients by the name of Bin Laden. And he just about fell off his couch.
Former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger stepped down from the position Friday.
We thought the meeting went well.
Kissinger was dethroned, and the commission went ahead under Chairman Thomas Kane and Vice Chair Lee Hamilton. But while Kissinger's appointment and resignation received all the attention, the White House was busy slipping another agent into the commission through the back door. In January of 2003, just weeks after Kissinger stepped down, it was quietly announced that Philip D. Zelikow would take on the role of executive director. As executive director, Zelikow picked the areas of investigation, the briefing materials, the topics for hearings, the witnesses, and the lines of questioning for witnesses. In effect, this was the man in charge of running the investigation itself. So who was Philip Zelikow? The commission's press release announcing his position described him as a man of high stature who has distinguished himself as an academician, lawyer, author, and public servant. Although they noted his position at the University of Virginia and his previous role as executive director for the National Commission on Federal Electoral Reform, curiously missing from this brief bio are the multiple conflicts of interest that show how the Bush administration essentially put one of its own in charge of investigating how the Bush administration failed on 9/11. In 1995, Zelikow co-authored a book with Bush's national security advisor, Condoleezza Rice. He was part of the transition team that helped the Bush administration take over the White House from the Clinton administration. He was even a member of Bush's post-9/11 Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. But perhaps most incredibly, Zelikow actually authored the Bush administration's 2002 national security strategy that outlined the preemptive war doctrine that would be used against Iraq. This, however, is something that not even 9/11 commissioners Kane or Hamilton themselves knew at the time the commission was formed.
Zelikow was the author of a very important document issued by the White House in September 2002 that really turned military doctrine on its head and said that the United States could become involved in preemptive war, preemptive defense, that we could attack a nation that didn't pose an immediate military threat to this country. And obviously in September 2002, it sure appeared that that document was being written with one target in mind, Iraq. Now, as I say, the author of the document at the time was anonymous. We didn't know that Philip Zelikow had written this thing, and that becomes known, I think, widely on the staff only in the final months of the 9/11 Commission investigation, and it appeared to pose yet another conflict of interest for Zelikow.
Just to be clear, the preemptive doctrine memo comes out in September of 2002. The commission is created formally in
December 2002.
Do Kane and Hamilton, when they hire Zelikow, are they aware of his role as the author of the preemptive doctrine?
I don't believe so.
These conflicts of interest were not merely theoretical. After the victim's family members discovered Zelikow's links to the Bush administration, he was forced to recuse himself from the proceedings of the commission, which he himself was directing, that had to do with the Bush White House transition or the National Security Council. Hearing of Zelikow's appointment, former counterterrorism czar Richard Clark, who Zelikow helped to demote during the Bush transition, remarked that the fix is in, wondering aloud, could anyone have a more obvious conflict of interest than Zelikow? Key staffers and even one of the commissioners threatened to quit the commission altogether when learning of Zelikow's history. When the 9/11 victims' family members discovered Zelikow's links, they protested his appointment. But unlike with Kissinger, this time their concerns were dismissed, and Zelikow plowed ahead. As even Zelikow himself admits, his ties to the very figures he was supposedly investigating are a legitimate concern, and any real investigation of the 9/11 cover-up would begin with him.
There's a whole welter of conspiracy theories about 9/11 floating around the internet, in video cassettes, and there's a whole cottage industry in this, which if you haven't read much about it, then you're a fortunate person. I get a lot of this. I actually figure very largely in a number of the key conspiracy theories. But be fair, I worked with Condi Rice, right? I worked with her in the administration of Bush 41. So I could be read as the plausible henchmen executing the cover-up. It's a legitimate concern, especially if I hadn't had 81 other staffers keeping their eagle eye on me.
Conveniently left out of Zelikow's story about the 81 staffers keeping their eye on his decisions is that they were staffers who were hired by him and under his complete control. In fact, Zelikow took over the hiring of the commission staff and even stopped staffers from communicating directly with the commissioners themselves. In the first few months, the 9/11 commissioners themselves rarely even visited the commission because Zelikow denied them their own offices or the ability to hire their own staffers. The most remarkable example of Zelikow's dictatorial control came in March 2003, just 3 months after the commission's 16-month investigation began. It was at that time, before the commission had even convened a single hearing, that Zelikow, along with longtime associate and commission consultant Ernest May, co-wrote a complete outline of the final report.
Before the staff even had its first meeting, Zelikow had written, along with his former professor, Ernest May, a detailed outline of the commission's report, complete, as Sheenan put it, with chapter headings, subheadings, and sub-subheadings. When Kane and Hamilton were later shown this outline, they worried that it would be seen as evidence that the report's outcome had been predetermined. So the three of them decided to keep it a secret from the rest of the staff. When the staff did finally learn about this outline a year later, they were alarmed. Some of them circulated a parody entitled The Warren Commission Report, Preemptive Outline. One of its chapter headings read, "Single bullet, we haven't seen the evidence yet, but really, we're sure." The implication was that the crucial chapter in the Zelikow May outline could have been headed Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. We haven't seen the evidence yet, but really, we're sure.
So what exactly did Zelikow do as executive director? He allowed information in the commission's final report derived from illegal CIA torture sessions, despite not having access to the evidence of those sessions themselves, which were later illegally destroyed. This included the testimony of alleged 9/11 mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was waterboarded 183 times in a single month, whose children were kidnapped by the CIA, who was told that his children were going to be tortured with insects, and who eventually confessed to a whole series of plots, including bombing a bank that didn't exist at the time he was arrested. More than one quarter of the footnotes in the final commission report source from this torture testimony, and as Zelikow himself admitted, quite a bit, if not most, of the commission's information on the 9/11 plot itself came from this testimony. Zelikow denied interviews and documents to staffers investigating the Saudi connection to the attacks, eventually firing one of them and removing the text of their investigation from the final report. He personally rewrote a commission staff statement to suggest a systematic link between Al-Qaeda and Iraq before 9/11, outraging the authors of the original statement. He worked behind his own staffers' back to stop them from serving the Pentagon a subpoena to answer about information NORAD was withholding from the commission. He sat on a proposal to open a criminal investigation into FAA and military officials who lied to the commission for months, and then forwarded that proposal not to the Justice Department, who could have brought criminal charges, but to the Inspector General, who could not. And he covered up information on Able Danger, a military intelligence team that had identified several of the alleged 9/11 hijackers in the country before 9/11.
After the initial disclosure, Dr. Zelikow came to me at the end of the meeting, gave me his card and said, "What you said today is critically important, very important. Please come see me when you return to Washington, D.C. I returned to Washington, D.C., January of 2004. Call in. They say, "We want to see you. Stand by." Nothing happens. A week goes by. I call again. They say, "We don't need you to come in. We have all the information on Able Danger we need. Thank you anyway." And that was where it ended.
All right. So the information that you told Dr. Zelikow in Afghanistan about the CIA interfering with your ability to provide actionable intelligence to the United States government, intelligence that might have helped them find out who caused 9/11, you were not permitted to testify about.
That's correct.
Okay.
From the initial outline to the final report, Zelikow carefully guided the process, hiring and firing the staff, directing their research efforts, deciding on witnesses, scrubbing information, and shielding his former colleagues in the White House from criticism. But perhaps more remarkable than the fact that the fix was in from the moment he took over the commission and began working on the predictive outline of the final report is that he had in fact written about 9/11 and its eventual aftermath in 1998, 3 years before September 11th. In an article entitled Catastrophic Terrorism, Tackling the New Danger, written for the Council on Foreign Relations Foreign Affairs in November 1998, Zelikow and co-authors Ashton Carter and John Deutsch ask readers to imagine a catastrophic act of terrorism like the destruction of the World Trade Center. Like Pearl Harbor, the event would divide our past and future into a before and after. The United States might respond with draconian measures scaling back civil liberties, allowing wider surveillance of citizens, detention of suspects, and use of deadly force. More violence could follow, either future terrorist attacks or U.S. counterattacks. Belatedly, Americans would judge their leaders negligent for not addressing terrorism more urgently. Zelikow's amazing prediction becomes somewhat less remarkable when we learn his own self-described expertise in the creation and management of public myth. In a separate 1998 article on public myths, Zelikow identifies generational myths that are formed by those pivotal events that become etched in the minds of those who have lived through them, before noting that the current set of public myths, formed during the New Deal in 1933, are currently fading. Convenient for Zelikow, then, that the Pearl Harbor event that would define the next generational myth, known as the War on Terror, would arrive just 3 years later, and that he would be in charge of the commission tasked with creating and managing the public perception of that myth. Indeed, given his central role in the cover-up of 9/11 and deflecting concern away from legitimate 9/11 suspects, any true investigation into the events of September 11th would involve a thorough interrogation of Philip D. Zelikow.
And again, you were just listening to James Corbett of The Corbett Report, sharing two of his reports on 9/11 suspects Rudy Giuliani and Philip Zelikow. To see the videos of these reports, go to CorbettReport.com, and I think they're also on YouTube. And just a reminder that 9/11 wake-up call shows are archived at RadioForAll.net, and that's the digit four, so RadioForAll.net. Once on the site, click on Contributors, and then on Cheryl, under the letter C, and the show should pop up in chronological order. 9/11 Wake Up Call airs at WWUH on Wednesdays at noon and 8 p.m., and on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. at WESU FM. You can also catch the shows by going to noliesradio.org, and they are also intermittently aired at the radio station at Boston College, sometime on Sundays between 6 and 10 a.m. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening.
Power to the people. Power to the people. Power to the people. Power to the people. Right on. Thank you.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Latin Waves with your hosts, Sylvia and Stuart Richardson. Latin Waves is more than just hot rhythms. This is a show about community, about creating a culture that is inclusive and based on fairness. Because everyone deserves dignity, respect, and has something to contribute. A new world is possible, and it all starts with us.
Welcome to this week's edition of Latin Waves. We speak to author Susan George about her newest book, Whose Crisis, Whose Future? Susan deconstructs who's responsible for the economic meltdown, and she offers healthy alternatives as to what we as citizens should be doing to get out of this crisis.
We're very privileged to have Susan George. She is the author of 14 books written in French and English and widely translated. She is president of the Board of Transnational Institutes in Amsterdam, a decentralized fellowship of scholars living throughout the world whose work is intended to continue to social justice and who are active in civil society in their own countries. She is also honorary president of ATTAC, Friends Association for Taxation of Financial Transactions to Aid Citizens. We're very privileged to have her on our show. She has many books. Her latest book is called Whose Crisis, Whose Futures. We're very privileged to have her on our show. Thank you for joining us, Ms. George.
Hello.
Now, in your book, you pose for us a question of the century. You know, we live in one of the most wealthiest times, and yet we seem to be riddled with problems, whether it's hunger, war, you know, economic downturns. Who are the architects of this crisis, and who should be responsible for?
I call them the Davos class. You know, Davos, the ski resort in Switzerland, where the masters of the universe get together every January and decide how they're going to organize themselves for the rest of that year and the following ones. And I think that they are a tiny class. They are nomadic. They are interchangeable in the sense that if you're the head of a very large bank this year, you'll be asked. But if you're not next year, you won't go. And companies and politicians are so anxious to go, well, companies have to pay quite a lot to go to Davos, but I think it's a class in the sense that they do have common interests, which they do defend. When push comes to shove, they will stick together, even if they might have, you know, the industrialist might have slightly different interests from the banker. But on the whole, they pull together. And unfortunately, our governments also pull with them. They govern pretty much on behalf of the Davos class. So those are the people that I think are causing all the crises, whether it is financial, ecological, whether it is the growth of inequality, or even the growth of conflicts, because the growth of conflict is in direct relation with climate change, and we're going to have new sorts of conflict because of that. One which will be important to Canada is the opening up of the Arctic, which is going to be open 3-4 months of the year, and we know that there will be state conflicts over who controls it and who controls particularly what's under it in terms of oil, gas, and so on. So I think the Davos class is really the responsible party for this. It's their crises, and the crisis is in plural in that title.
We are told of an economic crisis of global proportion. We are told that every person needs to somehow rally behind their governments to try to address the economic crisis. Yet what you're describing is that for too long, perhaps, we have been maintained in ignorance in terms of who's benefiting from this these policies of neoliberalism. So let's talk a little bit about how this crisis came about. And in your book, you address key solutions to it. But before we can find solutions, we need to address how those crises are created. What role has the privatization of public resources played in this crisis?
Well, when you speak of neoliberalism, I think you've hit it. Neoliberalism is like a religious doctrine, but it's an economic doctrine, which says that private is always better than public, which I think is total nonsense. It says that the market will always self-regulate and that we should allow it to work its magic because it knows better than anything else or anyone else what is needed and will allocate capital and will allocate people properly. This, too, is nonsense, as we have been able to see. I think that the Davos class has been extremely clever in placing us all in a position where we are obliged to pay. We're living in a period where the guilty are rewarded and the innocent are punished. And I found a remarkable figure in a paper by two people from the Bank of England, which I think is a pretty good reference, who said that the peoples of the world have paid $14,000 billion U.S. for the bailing out and the reconstitution of the banks for guaranteeing their future. Now, 14,000 million is a totally incomprehensible number, so I translated it into seconds. And if you have a second hand on your watch, and every second is $1, you have to watch the seconds tick by for 450,000 years before you'll reach 14,000 billion. That's how much we have already paid, and now in Europe, for example, this afternoon, I just came home from a very large demonstration because people are fighting to keep their retirement benefits here in France. And that is one way that we're being made to pay a second time. We've already paid in our taxes and we'll continue to do so. But now, in Europe, in Greece, in Spain, in France, and in Britain, there are deep cuts in welfare budgets, in education budgets, in health budgets, etc., which simply means that people are being asked to pay again. So I think that the distinction between public and private comes down to saying, well, the private sector has won. The banks have won. They are the ones in charge, and sometimes I say it's a joke, but it's a rather close-to-the-bone joke to say, well, we vote for people, and then they hand over our affairs to the bankers, so why don't we just vote directly for the bankers and eliminate the middleman? Because that is what is happening, as far as I can tell, in nearly all of the wealthy countries of the world.
And then the other part, I think, as you point out, is if we ignore the role the citizens play in not only creating solutions to these alternatives by imagining a different society other than one that's based on unlimited profit and, you know, putting one worker against the other. So let's talk a little bit about, I guess, the relationship of workers, because we often, in times of crisis, we tend to look inwards and think, well, we have to protect our own interests. So what if we're exploiting the Hondurans of the, you know, the little people in El Salvador? You know, we have to increase our wealth for our own, you know, retirement plans or our own benefits. How would you respond to people who think in that circular argument?
Well, I think that this is a classic reaction. If you look to the previous financial crisis of the late 1920s, 1930s, it was obvious that people were being encouraged to blame scapegoats and to blame people who were weaker than themselves, marginally weaker. In the case of the 30s, it was the Jews, the gypsies, the homosexuals, and anyone on the left. Now, since we're living under globalization, we're being placed in competition with workers from all over the world. And it's true we don't have international unions or very, very weak excuses for international unions, so it is hard for workers to protect themselves, and the temptation is to go for total protectionism. I think that some protectionism is warranted when it is a question of having your own systems of healthcare, of education, and so on protected. In other words, having your culture protected and not allowing any private operator to come in to the public service area. That's what the World Trade Organization is now pushing for, and many, many bilateral or regional trade agreements are pushing for. They're trying to get the permission for transnational corporations to go into any area that they like, with no limits on what they can invest and no limits on their power. It would be rather like the NAFTA agreement or the U.S.-Canadian trade agreement, which are among the most brutal in the world. And they are trying now in Europe to copy all of the provisions of the NAFTA agreement, including being able to bring legal proceedings against a government where the corporation says you or some of your measures are actually restricting my present or even future profits. And so that is a feature of the NAFTA, which these corporations are trying to get universally now. That's just one example. But what is less known is that over the last 30 years, there has been a massive transfer from the pockets of workers into the pockets of capital. In Europe, this transfer is on the order of 10 points of GDP. In other words, something like $1.3 trillion every year that workers used to be getting and that is now going to capital in the form of dividends or rents or other forms of rewards, the kind of money you can make in your sleep that you don't have to actually work for. And this has been a trend ever since the mid-70s, ever since particularly Reagan, Thatcher, and company. All of the European neoliberal governments have gone in exactly the same direction. And people don't realize that their wages have stagnated in terms of purchasing power because the capital holders, the shareholders, are asking for so much more, so much higher dividends, so much a higher percentage of return on their investment, that and corporations have given them this. And so they are actually profiting from the crisis. But this, again, is a very small slice of humanity. It's not most people. So there has been a very silent but ongoing robbery of working people throughout the developed world for the past 30-some years. And I think that this is also what leads to people blaming foreign workers because they have been replacing, and of course there is a phenomenon of delocalization or the threat of it, but I believe, and now I'm moving into the solutions, I believe that if we are smart, we in the North will invest massively in green economy and that we will then have the creation of jobs which will not be delocalizable and which will profit our own people. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself in this interview, but that would be one of the things I would recommend.
That's a wonderful segue. I think that it's not only important to point out the issues, but also the solutions. One of the key points that we're debating in Canada right now is the level of taxation, the way in which corporations have offloaded their tax burden onto the people. We have now the lowest paying corporations in Canada than at any time in history. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about this idea that if we tax the rich, the economy will suffer. And so, you know, there's no other choice but for the people, the workers, to absorb the taxes and to let the corporations run free.
That's nonsense, but it's ideological nonsense, which is repeated over and over again so that people will think that it's common sense. And that's what the neoliberals do. That's what the Republicans do in the United States. They also say, you know, liberty, freedom, and so on, which means freedom from government. Let the corporations do what they want. Let the private sector, let the market be free, etc. They use good words, and they try to convince people that this is the truth, but it's simply ideology which serves their purposes. The corporations all over the world are using tax havens to shelter their profits. They use something, a technique called transfer pricing, where they can put their profits in the low tax jurisdictions and their losses in the high tax jurisdictions. They are exporting capital like mad out of the South, where they often have the cooperation of local elites to send their profits from the South to tax havens. And just to give an example, the top tax bracket in the United States under a Republican president in the 1950s, Eisenhower, the top tax bracket was paying 90% of income above a certain level. Now it's 35%, and the brackets have been reduced as well. So there's money. There's plenty of money in the world. The world is awash in money, but we are not going after it where it is. And the rich also, the corporations, it's particularly unfair when they headquartered somewhere and they don't pay for the public services that they enjoy. I mean, for example, the roads to their centers or their shops or their stores or factories are kept up without their contributing. Their employees have ways to get to them either by public or private transportation that they're not paying for. Their health care, the health care of their employees, the education of their employees, so that they have literate, healthy people working for them, they don't contribute to that either, or they contribute only marginally. There are companies in the U.S. that are large, you know, and are making money and have paid no taxes for 5 or 6 years at all in the United States. So I put a bit in the solutions about something which sounds terribly boring, but accounting, if you look at how it's done, it's not boring because even accounting has been fixed so that international accounting, you can say, okay, here is my activity in, say, Canada, and then just put rest of the world so that you don't have to make clear exactly where your activity is, where your sales are, where your profits are, and where you're paying taxes. It's so opaque. It's very difficult for an individual government to know whether they are being fairly treated by a corporation or whether the corporation is avoiding or evading normal taxation. And this is something which needs a total overhaul. The G20 at first was talking about tax havens and closing them down and bringing back those $250 or $300 billion that should be going every year to different governments and which are not because they are avoided or evaded. But now they're not talking about it at all anymore. They just put some cosmetic changes in and the whole subject has been dropped. And the Canadian G20 was perfectly, obviously, geared towards not changing anything, not having any new taxes or even collecting the old ones. So we have a lot of work on our hands.
In your book, I wonder if you could address some of the solutions to recovering some of this war that we've been fighting against corporations to keep water and land in public hands.
Mm-hmm. First of all, I've mentioned that figure of $14,000 billion that the taxpayers of the North have already contributed to saving and guaranteeing the future of the banks. Now, I think that normally when you open up your wallet or your purse and you hand some money to someone, you expect to get something in return. In this case, we have received absolutely nothing. And I think that we should be receiving something, and that should mean that banks are either totally or partially socialized, by which I mean that they would then receive orders to devote X percent of their portfolio to investing in small and medium-sized companies that have, particularly those that have an ecological project or a social project. In other words, a project for having a company that's run by its workers or in which there is some form of worker interest in having the corporation function according to a participatory model. This is something I think we should be focusing on, because we know that these companies can be very well run. There are a lot of examples of cooperatives throughout the world. Canada has some, but there are some in every country, and we know that they can be successful and that they are fairer to their working people than those that are simply run for the benefit of stockholders. So we should be getting the banks on board to lend to companies with a ecological project. By that I mean alternative energy or alternative construction or alternative motors or whatever. We have all those possibilities on hand. We have the technology we need. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. And get the banks under control. That would be the first thing. The second would be massive public investment in a green economy, because there again we know that's where the jobs are, and we know that that is the key to the future, and also the key simply to the future of humanity, because if we allow climate change to continue, maybe Canada will survive, because it might become rather like, shall we say, Texas or Florida today. But most of humanity isn't going to survive, and even the lucky ones in the north are going to be having great problems with climate, refugees, migrations, new conflicts, resource wars. I mean, the future doesn't look very good if we allow climate change to take hold and have a runaway effect. So another solution is, of course, to go after the money where it is. And there's plenty of it. Now, I've already spoken about tax havens. That's one obvious direction. Another obvious direction is international taxation. This is something that my own organization, ATTAC, has been fighting for a dozen years now. Tax financial transactions, tax currency transactions. If we were to tax simply the derivatives that that caused so much of the present financial crisis, as well as currency transactions, we would have the sum of $600 billion to play with every year. And in France, we've now established a coalition with major trade unions and major North-South solidarity and ecological organizations in order to push for this kind of international taxation. Or at least the kind we want. But if we had those $600 billion, can you imagine what one could do? One could repair all the social systems in the north. We could use another third to halt global warming and transfer technology throughout the world, particularly to the south, where India, China, and so on, which are adding coal-fired power plants all the time. And we would have enough to accomplish the Millennium Development Goals, which the UN is pushing for the South. In other words, eliminate poverty, eliminate most of the causes of human distress, and provide a decent and dignified life for everyone. When I was writing that book, I was in a kind of state of perplexity, because I didn't see people mobilizing, but now perhaps we're beginning to see more people joining in a concerted battle to obtain some of these things. I think people got hit pretty hard by the crisis, didn't know where to look, but now I do see signs of participating and getting together to push for some of these solutions. So I think the solutions exist. The question, of course, is how do we mobilize to reach them? How can we make our governments act? Because right now, I have to face it, and so do we all, that the governments are governing on behalf of the banks. They only want to make changes around the margins, and they don't want to do anything fundamental, because business as usual is what their real constituencies want. So we have a tough road, but I don't think an impossible one.
Thank you so much for being with us. My guest is Susan George. She is the author of 14 books. Her latest is Whose Crisis, Whose Futures. Tell our audience how they can access your book.
Well, there will be full details on my site. The book is published by Polity Press. Its English title is Whose Crisis, Whose Future, with a question mark. Its French title is Leur Crise, in the plural, No Solution. That is to say, their crises, our solutions. And my website is TNI, like Transnational Institute, TNI.org/Susan George.
Thank you again for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. We have come to the end of our program. Latin Waves is a weekly syndicated program available to campus and community radios. Please visit our website, www.latinwavesmedia.com, to hear previous shows, connect to our media projects, and access other resources, or to support our efforts by making a safe PayPal contribution. I am Sylvia Richardson. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
The ruling was immediately binding on Costa Rica, but bureaucrats at the nation's Superior Notary Council have so far prevented marriage equality from starting.
We are excited to be welcoming the Beijing Queer Chorus to Portland, Oregon for a 10-day stay.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. New Zealand clears convictions for consensual gay sex, Costa Rican courts conflicted on marriage equality, and East meets West in queer musical collaboration. All that and more this week, now that you've chosen This Way Out.
I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending April 7th, 2018. New Zealand lawmakers made it the latest country on the planet to expunge the convictions of men for consensual adult gay sex before those acts were decriminalized in 1986. Almost 1,000 men will have their criminal records cleared of three acts that were illegal at the time: sodomy, indecency between males, and hosting a place for homosexual acts. This week's vote in Parliament follows an official apology that lawmakers made for those convictions last July. Applauding the pardons, Justice Minister Andrew Little said that the latest action sends a clear signal that discrimination against gay people is no longer acceptable, and we are committed to putting right wrongs from the past. The UK, Canada, Germany, and some Australian states have also offered official apologies for similar convictions. German lawmakers additionally approved financial compensation to each man convicted under their since-repealed Nazi-era laws, the equivalent of about $3,700 US for each year he spent in prison. Some queer activists are calling for similar compensation for New Zealand victims. Veteran campaigner Bill Logan told the Guardian newspaper that people's lives have been wrecked by an injustice that was done to them by the law, and it is really the least they can expect to have some kind of recompense in their old age.
But the situation remains perilous for LGBT people in the Indonesian province of Aceh. Four more men were arrested this week on suspicion of having engaged in homosexual activity. Each faces up to 100 lashes in the public square. Much of the civilized world recoiled at pictures of similar canings being carried out against two young gay men last year. Global advocacy groups, including Human Rights Watch, have called such humiliating and painful punishment torture under international human rights law. While Indonesia is considered to be the largest Muslim-majority country on earth, its federal laws are secular in nature, and same-gender sex is not technically illegal, although social stigma hangs heavy over LGBTQ people, and nonconforming queers have been prosecuted under the country's strict anti-pornography laws. Aceh was given special permission by the federal government to follow strict Islamic law, or Sharia, and has criminalized and punished gay sex since 2014. Pushed by conservative politicians and religious leaders, Indonesia's parliament is currently debating revisions to the National Criminal Code that would outlaw all sex outside of heterosexual marriage, including same-gender and premarital sex. Aceh authorities said the latest arrests were made by religious vigilantes and police officials who can invade workplaces and homes to search for suspected sex law violators at any time. Human Rights Watch called for the immediate release of the latest detainees, urging Aceh authorities to protect the public from marauding vigilantes who target vulnerable minorities.
Russia's state media regulator has blocked access to what is probably the country's most popular queer website, gay.ru, for violating a law that bans propaganda of non-traditional sexual relations. Citing a court ruling in Siberia that the site had violated the law, the agency ordered all internet service providers in Russia to block access to it, although it's still accessible from other countries. Gay.ru has been online for 20 years, offering support and national and international LGBTQ news. When the so-called No Promo Homo law was passed in 2013, the operators of the site were specifically told that they were not in violation. But anti-queer sentiment in Vladimir Putin's Russia has grown by leaps and bounds since then. A posting by the operators of Gay.ru this week noted that the website has always been intended for persons over 18 years of age and was clearly labeled as such. They said they were considering an appeal of the Siberian court ruling that supported the shutdown and a challenge to the federal agency's blocking of the site in international courts if necessary. The Russian LGBT network condemned the censorship in a post translated by a site called The Russian Reader and reported by The Advocate, charging that, as is customary in cases concocted by the authorities, it is impossible to comprehend what exactly the court deemed promotion of homosexuality.
But another city in Japan has started to recognize same-gender unions. Fukuoka Mayor Suichiro Takashima handed certificates legally acknowledging their unions to five same-gender couples in a ceremony at City Hall on April 2nd. The registrations don't come close to providing all the rights of marriage, but they do offer couples equal access to housing and medical care in the city of about 1.5 million people. Fukuoka becomes the second and largest city and seventh municipality in Japan to recognize lesbian and gay couples. Tokyo's Shibuya Ward got the ball rolling in 2015. Setagaya Ward soon followed. Sapporo became the first city to offer queer relationship recognition, while the town of Takaratsuka in Hyogo Prefecture began issuing certificates to gay and lesbian couples last June. Japan's conservative government has resisted any effort to recognize same-gender couples at the federal level.
A legally married couple in Singapore is appealing the annulment of their marriage after one transitioned from male to female. The city state criminalizes same-gender sex and bans the civil marriages of gay and lesbian couples. Trans people in Singapore can only change their gender on government documents after undergoing reassignment surgery. Faith and Bryce Volta registered their marriage with civil authorities in 2015. Bryce identifies as female. At the time of their registration, Faith, who registered as male, promised not to transition, but only before the wedding. She had gender reassignment surgery in March 2016 and received a new national ID card soon thereafter. 6 months later, the Registry of Marriages revoked their license to wed because they had become a same-gender couple. The couple won their initial legal skirmish in the Singapore High Court in January when Justice Valerie Theon approved their application to challenge the registry's decision. A full judicial review that began last week is reportedly underway.
Local media were reporting since Election Day in Anchorage, Alaska, on Tuesday, April 3rd, that an effort to prevent trans people from using the public bathrooms of their choice appeared to have been narrowly defeated. The queer advocacy group, Fair Alaska, issued a press release on Friday, April 6th, declaring victory. Proposition 1 would have overturned a city ordinance guaranteeing trans people the right to use sex-segregated public facilities, such as bathrooms and locker rooms, that conform to their gender identity, and required them instead to use facilities based on their birth certificate gender. The Anti-Queer Alaska Family Council gathered enough signatures to force the measure onto the ballot. Their website contorts the issue of transgender rights to an anti-marriage equality rant, claiming, for example, that the unions of same-gender couples are harmful to the development of children. The Anchorage Daily News finally reported, late on April 6th, that the anti-trans proposal had been defeated by 6 percentage points. Among the more than 250 U.S. cities and 18 states with similar protections in place, Fair Alaska proudly noted that their queer electoral victory makes Anchorage the first American jurisdiction to uphold transgender protections on a standalone ballot measure.
And finally, the American Medical Association sent a blistering letter to U.S. Defense Secretary James Mattis this week, challenging President Donald Trump's claim that transgender people should be barred from military service. A new study submitted to Mattis earlier this year contradicted a comprehensive review of the issue by the Pentagon during the Obama administration that cleared the way for the president to open service to qualified trans enlistees in 2016. The new Mattis study claims that trans people have high rates of mental health conditions such as anxiety, depression, and substance use disorders, and demonstrate extremely high rates of suicidal ideation and other comorbidities. The AMA letter said, in part, that the report to Mattis mischaracterized and rejected the wide body of peer-reviewed research and concluded that there is no medically valid reason, including a diagnosis of gender dysphoria, to exclude transgender individuals from military service. The letter, signed by AMA CEO James Madara, called Trump's claims about the exorbitant medical costs of caring for transgender service members negligible and compared them to a rounding error in the multi-billion dollar defense budget. Four different federal courts in different parts of the country have stopped the Trump administration from enacting the ban while its constitutionality is being challenged. Trans people continue to serve honorably in the U.S. Armed Forces, and the Pentagon continues to welcome new enlistments by qualified transgender personnel. As the AMA's Madara urged in his organization's letter to Mattis, faulty studies should not be used as a reason to deny patriotic Americans an opportunity to serve their country. We should be honoring their service.
That's NewsWrap, global queer news with attitude for the week ending April 7th, 2018. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
NewsWrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org, where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Sarah Sweeney.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
The Beijing Queer Chorus came into existence in 2008. They were the first gay chorus to emerge in China.
An ocean-spanning feature that combines queer arts and activism is a quintessentially This Way Out addition to our 30th anniversary month. But first, veteran queer journalist Rex Walkner's international reports were a key news source for This Way Out for many of our first 30 years. Now retired, Walkner has nonetheless been following Costa Rica's marriage equality battle and the recent presidential election there.
On January 9th, the Inter-American Court of Human Rights ordered Costa Rica to let same-sex couples marry. The ruling was immediately binding on Costa Rica, but bureaucrats at the nation's Superior Notary Council have so far prevented marriage equality from starting. Meanwhile, six marriage equality cases are pending in the Constitutional Chamber of Costa Rica's Supreme Court of Justice, four of them filed since the Inter-American Court ruling. The cases include actions of unconstitutionality against the nation's family code, which prohibits marriage equality, as well as amparos, which are individuals' demands for protection from discriminatory government action. These amparos target the government for not complying with the Inter-American Court ruling, the Superior Notary Council for blocking couples' marriages after the Inter-American Court ruling, and the Constitutional Chamber justices themselves for not having ruled on two older cases. Costa Rica's presidential election, held April 1st, morphed into a referendum on marriage equality after an evangelical Christian, Fabricio Alvarado, catapulted into first place in the first round, besting 12 other candidates, by making resistance to the Inter-American Court ruling the centerpiece of his campaign. Polls showed the runoff between the top two vote-getters to be too close to call, but on Election Day, marriage equality supporter Carlos Alvarado won, in a landslide, 61% to 39%. The Inter-American Court ruling is also binding legal precedent for 15 other countries without marriage equality: Barbados, Bolivia, Chile, Dominican Republic, Ecuador, El Salvador, Guatemala, Haiti, Honduras, Mexico, Nicaragua, Panama, Paraguay, Peru, and Suriname. In Mexico, marriage is a state, not a federal issue. About 40% of Mexican states have marriage equality so far. For This Way Out, I'm Rex Walkner. Oh,
And I'm Maria.
And together we're Zrazy.
And we're crazy about This Way Out.
Two queer choruses from very different worlds are finding harmony in life as well as in music with an exciting cultural exchange. This Way Out correspondent Steve Sims got backstage for an exclusive look at a song that stretches from Beijing, China to Portland, Oregon.
March was a monumental month for the Portland Gay Men's Chorus, and early on I set out to find more information about what was going to take place.
We are excited to be welcoming the Beijing Queer Chorus to Portland, Oregon for a 10-day stay with the chorus.
That's Rick Young, executive director of the Portland Gay Men's Chorus. He told me that it was going to be
10 days filled with a lot of interesting activities, concerts, programs, performances, and some fun, all wrapped into one fun time.
In addition to rehearsals,
we have a night where they're on the town going to the Armory to see the magic play, and we're taking a group of them to see the Portland Trailblazers and the Cleveland Cavaliers.
What makes this monumental for the Portland Gay Men's Chorus?
This is the first time that we've ever invited a foreign chorus to come. We have 23 members of the chorus coming, 19 singers, the conductor, accompanist, and two stage people.
I know of several international gay men's choruses, London, for example, but I didn't realize Beijing had one. And so I was wondering, how did it come about that we have Beijing coming to Portland?
Partly because I'm Chinese, and so that helps. I had an incentive. We got to see the Beijing Queer Chorus perform in Denver at Gala International. Gala International happens every 4 years, and 100-plus choruses from all over the world attend. This is the first time they've ever been able to come. So they got to perform in front of choruses and audience members. But it was really a closed concert. So when I saw them, I fell in love with them. They have an amazing story. And I thought it would be really exciting and interesting for us to be able to bring something like that.
Here is the Beijing Queer Chorus performing across the wide Missouri during a rehearsal at Reed College before their performances with the Portland Gay Men's Chorus.
See you.
It was quite an amazing experience to be in the auditorium for that performance. And the audience consisted of the Portland Gay Men's Chorus, who were on hand for rehearsal as well. So I asked Rick to tell me more about the Beijing Queer Chorus.
The Beijing Queer Chorus came into existence in 2008. They were the first gay chorus to emerge in China. 2008 was a kind of a momentous year. It was the Beijing Olympics, and the LGBT Center there decided that it would be nice to have some kind of performing face. So they created the Beijing Queer Chorus. Initially, it was called the Shiny Jazzy Chorus. It was a great name, but it was an opportunity not to identify necessarily as a gay chorus. And when they first formed, many of its members were actually performing in masks to hide their identity from the public. But and it wasn't really meant because being gay is illegal. Being gay was decriminalized in 1997, and it was taken off the list of psychological disorders in 2002. But it was really more around the pressure of family to marry and have children. So the need to protect one's identity in kind of that society was really important.
Rick earlier gave us a couple of reasons why he wound up inviting the Beijing Queer Chorus to come to Portland. But there's also one last very good reason.
When it became obvious that we were going to be able to become the first gay chorus to tour and perform across the country of China, it was at Gala that we were informed that my idea of going to China was actually going to come to fruition. So it kind of worked out. And so then as we were laying out the tour, we were doing a concert called Pacific Voices, which was all about the music of the Pacific Rim. And it just seemed to me and seemed to the board and to our artistic director that it was a natural jump to say, you know, we should have a guest artist because we do bring in guest artists on a regular basis. Let's stretch and let's see if we could invite the Beijing Queer Chorus. They were excited to be able to do it.
One thing that made this really possible for Portland Gay Men's Chorus to put together was something that they received last August.
Last August, we were informed we had won a $70,000 grant.
While the Portland Gay Men's Chorus is in China touring, they'll actually be on hand for a 30th anniversary.
So Portland Gay Men's Chorus came into existence in 1980. It's the fourth gay-identified chorus in the country. Its impetus was the assassination of Harvey Milk. That was the time when the San Francisco Gay Men's Chorus performed in public for the first time on the steps of City Hall. So we, in August 30th, we will step onto a plane in Seattle, Washington, and we will fly to Beijing and land on August 31st. And on September 1st, we will step out onto the stage in some place in a concert hall in Beijing to perform. And we'll be performing in four cities. We'll be performing in Beijing, Xi'an, which is famous for the Terracotta Warriors. It's a historical city of major importance. And then we'll be in Shanghai. And then we will end our concert series in Suzhou, which is the Portland's sister city. And it's the 30th anniversary of the Portland-Suzhou Sister City Association Alliance, okay, which is the city that helped build the Lanzhou Gardens here in Portland. So they have a really important connection to the city.
One of the challenges for the Portland Gay Men's Chorus has been the many languages they'll be singing in this concert. In addition to an Aboriginal language, they'll be singing in Korean, Portuguese, Spanish, Hawaiian, and Mandarin. This iconic gay chorus song has been translated into Mandarin and will be sung by both groups during the concert.
The Portland Gay Men's Chorus has a signature piece called Never Ever. It came from a larger piece called Naked Man, which was commissioned back in the 90s. And it's iconic in the LGBT community. It's iconic in Gay Men's Chorus. And so Never Ever is kind of the signature piece. And we've had that actually translated into Mandarin. It will be performed by both groups together. The first time it's ever been performed, we think, in Mandarin.
Here now is the Beijing Queer Chorus and the Portland Gay Men's Chorus performing that in Mandarin at a rehearsal before the public performances.
Thank you.
Beijing Queer Chorus arrived in Portland on March 11th for their 10-day visit. The public performances were held on Saturday, March 17th, and a matinee on Sunday, March 18th. Governor Kate Brown and Portland City Commissioner Nick Fish were on hand for the Saturday event to welcome the Beijing Queer Chorus. Portland Gay Men's Chorus can now look forward to their trip to Beijing in August. For This Way Out, I'm Steve Sims.
Our 30th anniversary celebration will continue with a two-part salute to some of our outstanding volunteer producers.
We set out on a year-long journey to learn about LGBTQ people around the world.
In the words of the great gay bard Walt Whitman, "I am large, I contain multitudes."
Recollections and reflections on three decades of queer radio, next time on This Way Out. Thanks for discovering This Way Out, brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. Program material this week came from Sarah Sweeney and Wenzel Jones, with thanks to Steve Pride, from Rex Walkner, and from Steve Sims. Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the Estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our individual listener donors, who make this program possible. Come by and join our 30th anniversary party at the all-new thiswayout.org, and remember us on Give Out Day, April 19th. Look for This Way Out Radio on Facebook, Twitter, SoundCloud, Stitcher, and Google+. Smile at Overnight Productions on Amazon. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and the entire This Way Out family, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KFAR Knoxville, Tennessee, 2BLU Katoomba, New South Wales, WRUV Burlington, Vermont, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned, y'all.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. Prothap Chatterjee, Executive Director of CorpWatch, has been tracking the involvement of private companies in the U.S. military for decades. His book, VIRAX, The True History of Whistleblowers, Drone Warfare, and Mass Surveillance, published by Metropolitan Books, which Chatterjee wrote with KPFA's Halil Bendib, tells the story of his efforts to connect the dots between NSA spying and the killings of civilians by U.S. unmanned aircraft in Pakistan, Yemen, and other countries. But it does so in an unusual way, in graphic novel form. Today, I'm joined by him to discuss what we now know about the state of surveillance and drone warfare. Prothap, long before Edward Snowden's revelations about mass surveillance came out, you had been working on the shadowy world of spy agencies and other parts of the military-industrial complex and the role of private contractors in warfare. Looking back now, how important was the U.S. response to the September 11th attacks in shaping what was to come later?
Well, the United States really felt it had been caught flat-footed after 9/11, that there was all this information that could possibly have been gathered, and in fact there was some evidence that the information around the 9/11 hijackers was available to intelligence agencies and had never really been utilized or analyzed. So in the last now 17 years, there has been many billions of dollars spent on trying to figure out how to prevent a repeat of that, to make sure that all the information that is possible to gather is gathered and analyzed. Now, unfortunately, since 9/11, our use of data has exponentially increased. So the amount of data the U.S. is gathering is it's like a tsunami. It it's not just one tsunami; it just keeps coming. So there's a huge amount of data being generated by us, by businesses, by government, and the forms in which this data is transmitted also change by the month, by the year. You have new apps, things like Signal and Facebook Messenger. And so the government is trying its best to ensure that it captures all that data and then digs through it. Now, the problem is, of course, digging through actually voluminous amounts of actually terrible, inconsequential, often disconnected pieces of data and making sense out of it. And that's actually very, very hard.
Right. And in trying to think about the trajectory of what has happened. So after September 11th, there was the Iraq invasion, and there was the broadening of the number of private companies that were involved in a military-industrial complex, which already was very much populated by these public-private partnerships.
The military-industrial complex can be said to live, largely in the not largely, but a big chunk of it is in Northern Virginia, right? And if you fly into Dulles Airport, when you leave the airport, you see the signs of all these companies, Lockheed and BAE and all these other companies, and they have traditionally made a lot of hardware and some software. So they built bombs, they built planes, etc. But what we really saw after 9/11 was an explosion in these sort of information technology companies. And this is, some of them are brand new, many of them. I mean, they're literally hundreds, thousands, easily tens of thousands of new companies that have grown out of, this desire for information, this desire for new technology. So these companies are making a fortune. I mean, the Pentagon's budget is, of the order of $500 billion a year. And a huge amount goes to technology. Of course, the government is also buying food and boots and things like that. But a huge amount is spent on new technology, and these companies profit because essentially there's not really a lot of competition. A lot of it is not necessarily a lot of stuff, particularly in the world of intelligence, takes place behind closed doors. There's a black budget, and then that black budget is spent between people in the know, who are typically people who used to work for the government. There's a revolving door here, no great surprise, and that's who profits out of it. And they produce technology that actually, and this is kind of the point of my writing, doesn't work. It doesn't produce any great information that can spot quote-unquote terrorists, or really much at all.
How do we understand just what you're describing about the mushrooming of private companies, especially focused on data collection or working around data, with the larger mushrooming of private companies doing the same that are not necessarily hooked into the military? Are these on parallel tracks, or is there some interaction? Because obviously from the 90s on, this exploded.
Sure. I mean, I mentioned, of course, the military manufacturers, hardware manufacturers like Lockheed and BAE and what have you. But of course, they're not the only people in this in this field. They have a big chunk of it. The telecom providers are a big part of it. So these are not necessarily people you'd think of as military contractors, but they always have been. This is not necessarily new at all, right? I mean, from the beginning of the creation of modern telecommunications, primitive telecommunications, the government has always worked, you know, in tapping the telegraph wires and then the undersea telephone cables, now, you know, Wi-Fi systems, etc. So what we think of as sort of private industry, the people who provide our phone systems and our internet, they work very closely with government. The government has always maintained a relationship with these companies. They've bought, of course, services from them. They've also provided seed funding. The CIA has an investment arm. This is not actually secret. It's called InQtel in Palo Alto. And they provide money to create new technologies and figure out new ways of using this stuff. And I will say there's a caveat. I was at a few years ago, I was at Stanford, and I heard the head of the NSA saying, you know, you think we collect a lot? Do you have any idea how much Google and Facebook and Amazon collect? You know, it pales into insignificance. And he's not wrong. The private industry, separate from its collaboration with the U.S. government, is gathering data for us all the time, as we're discovering today,
sure,
you know, with the revelations of Facebook and the data that was gathered on voters and citizens and what have you. So this is big business, right? And it has there's an interesting theory. I think there's an Israeli writer who's written about this, that we know the internet was created by the military. That is mm-hmm. not necessarily a secret. And in fact, the reason the internet was created was so that they would have a communication system in the case of a major attack. It was distributed. Now, there's a theory, I don't know much about it, but that it was actually not simply created to provide information distribution, but also to keep an eye on dissidents. So, in fact, what we think of is this great democratic force, the internet, where, you know, anybody can speak up, anybody can be heard, you can organize instantly around the world. In fact, supposedly was conceived of a way, and I don't want to get into any kind of conspiracy theory in that sense, but the government has always found it useful to have a communication system that has some control of. Now, in a lot of countries, telecommunication systems are controlled by the government. That has never been true in the U.S. However, there has always been a very close relationship between the two. So that's a big part of industry. And now, of course, there's all the apps in Silicon Valley. All of these people, you know, from Angry Birds, you know, to Google, they have relationships with the military. I mean, they send data to the military.
Indeed, there's right now a controversy of Google employees taking a stand against something called Project Maven, a Pentagon joint venture with Google to use artificial intelligence for video imaging, which people fear might be used for drone strikes.
Well, I mean, it has been. I mean, in fact, CorpWatch, where I work, recently published a report that I am co-author of called Drone Inc. And in it, we look at all the technology in drones. We look at not really the companies that build drones, because drones themselves are just, you know, planes that can be remotely controlled. But the technology on board the drone, the video cameras, the listening devices, the cell phone tracking devices, the people that operate it, the technology they use, most importantly, the algorithms that they use to try and get information out of this. Because at the end of the day, having all the data is actually kind of useless. There's just so much data. What matters is trying to make sense out of it. Now, there are several factors that actually make it very difficult to make any sense out of it. First and foremost being the operators of this technology, the drones themselves, typically are kids straight out of high school. And my book, Virax, is really about whistleblowers, and in particular military whistleblowers, Air Force whistleblowers, and I interview a bunch of them in the book, and perhaps around nine. I'm not sure if all of them are in the book, but many of them are. And typically they've come to the military where they operate these drones, they track people's cell phones, they look at people through video cameras from halfway across the world. But really, they've just gotten out of high school. They've typically come from rural America. They've not traveled overseas. They very rarely speak Dari or Pashto or Arabic. So they are the people who operate this technology. They point the cameras. They gather the data. They analyze the data. So one of the biggest flaws is actually not really even the technology, but the fact that the people who are looking at this are typically pretty young with no real experience, and they are required to make life and death judgments. And this is, I think, for many of them, this once they realize their role in this, it becomes actually a huge burden. Especially if they're involved in combat, even from here, from California, where we have bases, or Nevada or New Mexico, they too suffer from what's called PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, because of the fact that they have actually been involved directly in selecting and eliminating, killing people. So this has an impact. Even if you didn't pull a gun or you didn't stab somebody, you know that you have participated in the act of killing, and you know that there is a very great chance that you made a mistake, and that the consequences for the family or the civilians that are targeted by drones is dramatic, and in fact may even create blowbacks. So there's a real problem, and I think soldiers themselves are very aware of this, despite their youth and their lack of knowledge of the countries they're bombing.
Well, and that speaks to one of the themes that runs through Virax, which is that although a lot of us in the United States are alarmed by the mass collection of data on us, that we often miss the connection to the gathering of data and targeted assassinations in other countries, which invariably involve more than just the purported target. And you talk about that a big factor in this is the desire by the U.S. military to fight wars remotely, fight wars without sending in troops, although obviously that has happened in the last two decades. But still, there's a desire to limit that as much as possible and have the U.S. exercise its military might with fewer consequences domestically, although increased consequences elsewhere. When did that push happen in the U.S. military? And when did it start intersecting with the availability of all of this data collected through mass surveillance?
Well, I mean, it's funny you raise that question. It is a theme that I have explored in my previous writing. My book before Virax was Halliburton's Army, and the book before that was Iraq, Inc. And it looked at the whole-scale privatization of the U.S. military. And the reason for that was also to get soldiers out of the trenches, out of, you know, to reduce the number of Americans that were overseas who might be targeted. So really, when did this begin? Well, soon after the Vietnam War is really when the U.S. was in Vietnam. Is that so many body bags came back. People were so upset because of the draft. It became politically unacceptable to participate in major wars. And so post 9/11, when the Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney and George Bush were planning, you know, the invasion of Afghanistan and the invasion of Iraq, they looked to figure out a way to do this without sending too many troops. So now that, of course, we could get into that in some more detail, but clearly, you know, that still involved putting people on foreign soil and risking their lives. So with the advent of the technology that made it possible to fight the war without going there, this was, you know, taken up by Obama, who also was elected on a platform in which he had said he would bring soldiers back home.
Indeed.
It made it possible. But it would be wrong to assume, much as I would like to blame George Bush for the war, or Barack Obama for the war on terror, Barack Obama for the drone war, to see this as purely driven by these individual presidents or their political ideologies. This is really the arc of military logistics. It's the arc of technological progress. And in my previous book, Halliburton's Army, a lot of people in hearing about the book or learning about Halliburton just assumed this is about how the Republican Party, you know, was super evil and they did things the Democrats would not have done. But the book actually opens up with Donald Rumsfeld condemning the Democratic Party in the U.S. war in Vietnam when they used Brown and Root, later part of Halliburton, to support military logistics in the field. This is not something that is partisan. And had the places been switched and the Democrats had been in power right after 9/11, and let's say the Republicans had been in power instead of Obama, it is likely that they would still have privatized the military. They would have still sought ways to keep soldiers out of the field, and they would have used the power of remote warfare, the near instant quality of our communications. That is not really, you know, it's interesting because people say under Trump things must be so much worse. Well, they're not that different from under Obama. They're about the same. And even if you said that Trump is killing twice as many people as Obama, well, Obama killed 10 times as many people as George Bush did. So it is really sort of a trajectory. It has plateaued somewhat because of the lack of availability of sufficient personnel to actually operate these machines. So had Trump wanted to expand it as much as Obama did, it's actually not possible. So he is stymied by the lack of trained troops and technology.
That's Pratap Chatterjee, co-author of Virax, The True History of Whistleblowers, Drone Warfare, and Mass Surveillance. I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So you're making the point that there's a long history leading up to the point that you started in the book Virax, which jumps off in 2011 when WikiLeaks handed over to you and a number of other journalists the so-called spy files. What did you end up with, and what did those fragments, where did it send you?
Sure. In 2011, I was living in London. I was working for a non-profit group called the Bureau of Investigative Journalism. And I had known Julian Assange and WikiLeaks for a little while, and he proposed working together with a lot of other groups, including the Washington Post and groups in France and Germany, etc., on this data trove that they had just uncovered or had been given, which was data on the companies that listen to our phone calls and provide the technology to be able to intercept and analyze this information. Now, I was aware of this. This isn't necessarily news. Those of us that follow the subject are aware that companies have been doing this for a long time. I was not really aware of the scale of it. So I have to say I was taken a little by surprise. I went to and this is depicted in the book, I visited a technology fair where these companies were selling this technology to police agencies, intelligence agencies, the military. And I had no idea how much of our technology, this is years before Snowden, 2-3 years before Snowden came out with his revelations. And so I was kind of horrified that everything we did could be tracked. That's not to say that all that data could be gathered. That's not to say that they know everything that's happening, but they have access to all that data. And how easy it was to hack into this kind of information. And in many ways, Julian Assange and WikiLeaks were sort of pioneers in explaining to journalists how to protect themselves. Until then, very few journalists, you know, turned on, you know, encrypted software, etc. And WikiLeaks was like, you got to be careful. This stuff is being, you know, your information can be tracked. You need to be able to protect your sources, the whistleblowers, etc. And very few people understood that until then. And even though there's been a lot of criticism of all the work that WikiLeaks has done, they brought together journalists from around the world, and I was part of several of those projects in Afghanistan, Iraq, then the spy files, in which they brought, typically before that, journalists had worked, you know, maybe a television station and a newspaper station, newspaper teamed up together. Maybe there were three or four. But WikiLeaks brought dozens, even hundreds of journalists together to collaborate and work together, which is really kind of an impressive undertaking. And the book opens with us looking at these files and looking at, in this particular instance, companies who are mostly working on providing technologies to repressive regimes in the Middle East, to Syria, to Egypt, to Libya. We didn't really look so much as the companies in the United States that did that. But it was clear to all of us that these technologies were available and used by the U.S. government also. And what we learned later, and the book opens with me also meeting with Laura Poitras, who's one of our collaborators there, who says you think this is bad what they're doing in Libya and Egypt? You should see what the National Security Agency is capable of. And you know, I knew who they were, but I didn't really understand the details of it. And it was only when Edward Snowden came along, produced all these documents, that we realized how much industry had collaborated with government, how much information was being sucked up for the purposes. And this is another question that you just raised. I think a lot of people are upset about this because they feel like their information is being taken and they're being tracked. And I would say that I hate to sort of side a little with the military. The military isn't really interested in, you know, what we had for lunch today or where we're going. You know, what they're interested in is actually trying to figure out, you know, who might be blowing up a bomb or some such thing. And but in order to get that information, they need everybody's information.
Sure, although there is some revelations around radicals being tracked as well.
Absolutely. And the government has always done that. The government has always tracked, you know, animal rights activists. You know, they have always, you know. So, I mean, that data is useful for, I'm not sure that they're tracking everybody, but in order to be able to track a few people, they have to have the data of everybody. So that's available for abuse. So in not stopping that, Barack Obama, you know, made a grave mistake because he essentially handed over all our data to Donald Trump, right? Now, whether you like Donald Trump or not, the fact that this information can be now utilized by anybody who has, you know, access to the system is worrisome, whether it's Obama or it's Trump.
Right. I think both would worry me. And you talk in Virax about the different components to that surveillance. There's the tracking. There's the hacking. So obviously, if they're particular targets, then people within the national security state could say, Pratap Chatterjee, he's a journalist, we want to focus on him particularly, see who he's talking to, is he in touch with whistleblowers? So that's a bit different than just throwing out a big net and grabbing a lot of data. But then, of course, there is that component of throwing out this net and ending up with mountains and mountains of data. And then the crucial question is, what do you do with it? So what's the role of analysis in the story?
So this is where it gets very sort of esoteric and fuzzy, because with all that data, and it is almost, you know, inconceivable how much data there is. I mean, so much so that even the NSA with their giant new storage center in Utah that, you know, could hold more data than anybody could ever dream of, they can still only hold 3 days' worth of data. You know, it is virtually impossible. So you need to start to figure out ways to simplify that data. And so this is where algorithms come in. So the quote-unquote analysis is really using mathematics to break apart this information and to construct, you know, possible to find threads, shall we say, and to be able to lead to potential, you know, suspects or what have you. So, So the way we explain it, I interviewed this mathematician in Britain at the University of York, who said, you know, essentially what we have to do is we have to reduce people to vectors. You know, we have to reduce them to a number and a direction, and then we have to construct more complicated vectors and use those vectors to be able to figure out, you know, where these people are going. And this is, let's say, in the case of, let's say, a drone camera, where you have a video camera. You want to see where this person is going and see who they interact with. But you can extrapolate that idea to our phone calls, right? You have a phone call, and the phone call goes from A to B, and that is useful, but only if you get a lot of phone calls and you establish patterns. So now, once you spot those patterns, you need to figure out whether this is a valid pattern or not. And that's where it actually gets really complicated. The FBI has this term. They call it Pizza Hut cases. And the idea is that it's probably less true these days. Maybe you'd call it the Deliveroo or the what are the companies that deliver food? Caviar or some such app. Is that back at least 20 years ago, the people that got the most phone calls in the United States were people doing takeout, right? So if you were to look at and whether you're a terrorist or a government employee or anybody, you bought food and you called the same places. So what happened is the government started to realize that just by the system of trying to create patterns of finding where everybody was calling, what the center was, they were actually having a lot of these sort of false positives and false negatives, where they were actually finding people who actually had nothing to do with it. Now, you would think that they would have gotten a lot smarter about this, but it is actually very difficult to get beyond that, because the problem with having data is that you are restricted to that data, right? And so even though you have everybody's telephone calls, you don't know what happens outside those telephone calls. You don't know what happens when people meet in person. So you then narrow as opposed to enlarge. I mean, we think of this net as being, you know, all-encompassing. Actually, it's not. Because if I was planning, you know, a bomb or some such thing, last thing I would do is telephone somebody with it, right? I would try and stay off the telephone, right? If I was trying to attack somebody, I would not do it when I could see a drone or hear a drone above me, and you can see and hear them. So there is a simple way to not to be tracked. So what happens is the government is generally left with a lot of bad information, right? And so they're trying to cobble together a plausible scenario by which they can make find quote-unquote terrorists. So what they revert to is something that they've always done for a long time. And that was explored actually really well in a book called The Terror Factory. It's a book looking at every person that the FBI has arrested since 9/11, every Muslim that they've arrested and put behind bars. And what they discovered was the government was actually planting weaponry or fake weaponry on these people. And then as soon as they agreed to move forward with the plot, they were arresting them. And The U.S. government has very rarely, when you read about these cases, you think, well, of course, that was a bad guy and they caught him. And he was, you know, he was intercepted before, you know, he had time to do anything bigger. But once, as Trevor Aaron is the name of the writer of Terror Factory did, once you add up all the cases, you realize what the government is doing is taking the data they have and trying to make a case out of it and trying to add, you know, its own theories to it, because actually that data is relatively useless. And this is one of the biggest problems with relying on technology to provide justice. I mean, if it was possible to spot you know, a murderer using technology, you know, we would be able to prevent crime and robberies in the United States. And we can't. I mean, but really what we're doing, and this is the analogy I think that is probably the best, is imagine that there was a serial killer on the streets of Berkeley and you wanted to figure out who that person was. Well, the best way you can figure that out is going and interviewing neighbors and, you know, having people, you know, write down information, sit down, analyze it, and come up with theories on the ground. But what if you were to hire a group of people in Inner Mongolia, aged 18, who spoke no English, and ask them to figure out who the perpetrator of this, the serial killer was in Berkeley? I mean, you would have no chance whatsoever. But that is actually what we're doing. So we think we have a lot of information. I mean, these kids in Inner Mongolia, let's say they have access to all of our telephone calls and they can watch from the sky, they still would not be able to figure out what was happening because it would be impossible. But that is exactly what we're trying to do. So the very fact that you have information, I think it is, we think of information as cure for everything and technology. We think of technology as a cure for everything, but it isn't. It actually makes us think we have knowledge that we don't really have.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with the co-author of Virax, The True History of Whistleblowers, Drone Warfare, and Mass Surveillance. That's published by Metropolitan Books, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Pratap Chatterjee, who wrote the book along with Halil Bendib, is executive director of CorpWatch. In Virax, you make the case, and you've just made the case, that the technology that the U.S. spends billions of dollars on, the surveillance, the drones, actually add up to a very inaccurate picture of what's going on. And that actually seems fairly obvious, right? That having people on the other side of the world trying to make sense of what they're seeing in a foreign country on grainy video footage added together with some surveillance of people's cell phone calls, but the chances are that that is going to be a pretty ineffective way of finding out what's going on, which raises the question, does the military actually care? I mean, is there a logic to this that propels it along? Given how obviously faulty this is going to be, why would they pursue it?
I mean, I think the simple answer, there's one word, it's politicians, right? The military is actually aware of how bad the data is. They know that this is not the way to win a war. A number of generals in the report Drone Inc., at the end of the report that we produced for CorpWatch.
And I should say we have a link to that on our website, againstthegrain.org.
Well, thank you. And in that, I cite a general from the Army, a general from the Air Force, and a general from the Navy, each of whom say, we know the system doesn't work. But, I mean, in the absence of the political will to send soldiers overseas, in the presence of a political desire to be seen as tough on terrorism, they're making the best of a bad job. The politicians say, you need to go and fight a war in Syria. Right. And we will give you the money and we'll give you the technology. Just don't get any Americans killed and come back and prove to everybody that you've been effective. So the military goes off and drops bombs and fights wars. I'm not saying that they don't believe in the mission. I think they do. But I think they are also quite aware of how inaccurate it is. And it is quite frustrating. I know somebody who was in the National Security Council. I won't say any more than that. For many years, for 10 years. And this person said that when the politicians, this member of the National Security Council, who went to 500 deputies meetings and worked with Obama on a lot of these things, said, the politicians, like Obama, would come and say, we need to do this. You know, send the drones here and do that. And the soldiers, the generals would say, well, we can't do that. It is actually not possible. Our equipment cannot get you the information you want. It cannot win this war or bring you back, you know, the kind of results you desire. But they kind of had no choice, right? It was their government to obey, their duty to obey the politicians, and the politicians, you know, had to prove to the public that they were doing what they were doing. So it is almost a, you know, it's just a catch-22.
It's interesting, and certainly the idea that politics is driving it makes sense, but it's not that the public is clamoring for drone strikes. And in fact, these efforts are supposed to be secret, or, you know, they won't either acknowledge it or deny it and so on. And so it's interesting why the motivation then by politicians to do these attacks is there. Is it about a notion of projecting American power beyond the U.S. public?
Absolutely. It is about projecting American power. It is about the U.S. Sees itself, and this is true of Trump, Obama, Bush, Jimmy Carter, all of these presidents and all of Washington, D.C. sees itself as a superpower in charge of the world, right? And that, and of course, many people believe, many of them say this is the force for, a benevolent force for peace, etc. We know that's not true. But they will not deny, I think, the fact that they see the projection of U.S. military might as being a way to be able to ensure that markets are open, that that business comes their way, that politics is done in the best interest of the United States. And the best interest of the United States is not the interest of every individual, but the best interests of the quote-unquote economy and therefore business. So at the end of the day, I mean, I don't believe there's a lot of listeners who would probably disagree with me in saying that, of course, the war on terror is a war about oil, and Bush simply did it, you know, to enrich his friends at Exxon or Shell or whatever. I'm not sure that I would go that far. I would say that there is a there is a group of people, you know, who are friends with each other, and they are executives of big companies, and they are generals, and they are politicians. And so they do what's good for themselves. So you go out with your friends and let's say go to a certain restaurant or go for a certain game or see a certain movie. These guys do things together because they have always controlled the world. They're meritocrats, the elites. And this includes the liberals, too. This is not just, sure, you know, the Republicans and the and Donald Trump.
Indeed, it is, Hillary Clinton, were she president right now,
would be doing exactly the same thing. Hillary Clinton's war would not be any different from Donald Trump's war at all. So the U.S. does business. I mean, it is sort of interesting to see, you know, Bill Clinton, after he left power, you know, goes in, and Hillary Clinton, they give speeches to bankers and to, you know, we condemn rightly Donald Trump for his business dealings with Russia. Well, Bill Clinton had similar dealings, you know. Hillary Clinton was opening up, you know, helping support natural gas exploration throughout the former Soviet Union. Bill Clinton was taking money from Russian banks and things like that. There is a world of wealthy people. I mean, Bill Clinton and Donald Trump's families have been friends for decades. This is not necessarily, Barack Obama might be new to that world, but now he is, you know, very much part of it. You know, he holidays with Richard Branson. He travels the world, does the same thing. So for these people, it's business as usual.
And it's pretty transparent. I mean, not that things don't go on behind closed doors, but most of this actually doesn't. I'm not talking about the things with the national security state, but the larger project that you're talking about here, right, of the business class in the United States and its imperial stance, a lot of that is very transparent. It's just about the exercise of power.
Absolutely. I mean, Donald Trump may have Peter Thiel advising him, but, you know,
the PayPal.
From PayPal. But Barack Obama had Jeffrey Immelt, CEO of General Electric. And really, is there that much of a difference between PayPal and General Electric? No, they're big business. I mean, that's and it's their job to, you know, make as much money as they can. And if government will help them, they're all for it. If government stands in their way, well, they will stand up and protest, you know, against, you know, trade wars and things like that. So it is in their interest. I mean, I'm not sure, war is in the interest of certain companies, you know, obviously the people who make this kind of hardware and software. It isn't necessarily the best thing for businesses, let's say, that are in the places that are being bombed. Like, I'm sure the oil industry is actually not really that happy about Iran and Iraq. Because it actually hasn't
paid...
It creates too much chaos and it hasn't paid dividends for them because to this day, U.S. companies are not benefiting out of Iraq and they have not benefited of Iran for years. So they're not always in favor of this. But the U.S., I think, goes into these things not so naively because they think that they, if they control, they will be able to deliver business. And I do believe that George Bush felt that he wasn't trying to create chaos. I mean, I'm sure that Naomi Klein would disagree with me there. But he was there because he thought he could stabilize the area and make it open for American business.
Sure, open up the markets. And I should say I'm speaking with journalist Prithap Chatterjee about his book, Virax, The True History of Whistleblowers, Drone Warfare, and Mass Surveillance. And I'm Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So bringing things then to the present, you were saying that although people are fearful that under Trump, at least drone warfare will be worse than under Obama, and you're saying that there's much more continuity than rupture. It's now been 5 years since the revelations of Edward Snowden, and a lot has changed beyond Donald Trump replacing Barack Obama. We know now about data collection happening on a phenomenal scale in private businesses. Would you say that there are any sort of qualitative changes from then to now in terms of what we know? More of the same, maybe just enlarged? How do you see it?
Well, I think there's been a lot of positive changes as a result of Edward Snowden. The first is that Silicon Valley has realized that it's actually bad for their business to be obviously giving away all our data. And so nowadays, a lot of companies have turned on encryption at the source. So Facebook Messenger, and this is not to support Facebook at all, has much better encryption than it did before. And that's because of Edward Snowden.
And you mean giving away our data to the U.S. government? You're not meaning collecting our data for their own purposes?
Oh, no. They're still collecting it for their own purposes. I should clarify, yeah. So it is now possible and actually fairly common, you know, I know a librarian at UC Berkeley. I know a Japanese teacher who used Signal. These are not people who are, involved in visiting Iraq.
This is the encryption app.
You're using Signal, which is an encryption app by which you can send messages that cannot be tracked simply because Signal itself doesn't collect the data on its servers. So the only person who has access to the data is yourself and the recipient. Now, that, of course, doesn't prevent somebody from grabbing your phone and arresting you and reading your phone. But it still is a lot better than in the past when information just leaked out and could be gathered by pretty much anyone. In fact, hackers were able to intercept people's phone calls and messages, for about a $50 device. And that is no longer true. So I will say that since Edward Snowden revealed the scale of surveillance and data interception, Silicon Valley has been much more cognizant about making sure that this data is encrypted. And a lot of people, I would say hundreds of thousands of people, millions of people now are much more careful about what they do. So that has been very, very good, I think. The government has made some, Congress has made some changes and restricted the kind of data that the intelligence agencies can gather, but there are always loopholes and there are always new agreements and technologies can be used. So even though there have been some changes in Capitol Hill in terms of revising rules around FISA collection, which is the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act court. So that's what it is. So it is a court that allows the government to tap people's phones. So those rules have been tightened a little bit.
But hasn't there also been legislation passed that allows your internet service provider to hand all your data over?
Part of the problem is that even though some advances have been made, there have been other things that have been done. And WikiLeaks actually recently published a trove of data from the CIA showing how the CIA was trying to figure out ways to get around encryption by getting to the root of the phone devices themselves. Because the thing is, As I noted, if I have access to your phone and I have, you know, and I can read your data right now, it makes it harder to intercept everybody's email and be able to read it all at once. But if you can get, if you can hack the actual root of the phone, you can have access to that data. So that is that it. There are new technologies created every day by which you can get access to that data. Does the government have access to all of that? Are there ways around that? You know, these are things that are actually kind of hard to answer. But I would say that, A, because people have become more security conscious, more security options are available. Many more services have encrypted their information. I mean, it is for the big businesses in the United States, like Facebook, like Google, etc., the idea that European governments are starting to say you cannot take people's information, and if you do, we won't do business with you, is a problem for these very profitable companies. So it is still in their interest to let's say collaborate with the government in tracking certain individuals. It is probably not in their best interest to give all the data over. But as you pointed out, that doesn't mean they don't use it for their own purposes. That's how they make their money.
And probably creating profiles even more detailed than the NSA's mass grab.
Absolutely, yeah. So that problem has not gone away.
Let me end by asking you about what, if anything, has changed since Edward Snowden's revelations in 2013. Regarding whistleblowers, your book, Virax, talks about people who've come forward who were involved in drone strikes from the U.S. military side, who were willing to talk about what they did and how it all worked. After Snowden's revelations and the call for off with his head, and then, of course, the imprisonment and release of Chelsea Manning. Do you think that the situation for whistleblowers has changed at all? And are people as willing to come forward as they were?
I think actually I would say that's a bright spot in our political landscape. And it's not, and it's partly because of Edward Snowden. It's also partly because of the election of Donald Trump. Is a lot more people in government agencies are willing to take risks now. And figure out ways to thwart the government from doing things that are wrong. So the book Virax actually ends in 2017. So it covers part of the Trump administration, but only the first few months. And so most of the whistleblowers that we talk to in our book are people who spoke out in the Obama era. I do know from my conversations with people in government that I don't think people, certainly government servants, and there are many millions of them, or a couple of million of them, have been cowed. I think, in fact, if anything else, they've been emboldened and they realize that it is their job to go out and blow the whistle. And that's what this book is about. The book is really kind of a call to action. It's a celebration of these whistleblowers. Some say, you know, it's kind of a disturbing story of death and destruction. But it is also hopefully an empowerment story. And one of the things is I've written a lot of technical stuff about how the technology works and how it doesn't work. I know I've also written about the law, and there are lawyers who talk about this stuff. My feeling is that really, things will change when young people in the military and civil servants, you know, read comic books. A plug for my for Virax again here, and decide that they need to delve deeper. And so that's kind of why we wrote the book, and why I think things will change. I think there is hope, and you know, it's interesting in the year and a quarter that Trump has been president. He has actually not prosecuted whistleblowers in the way Obama prosecuted more whistleblowers than all the other presidents before him, and throw Trump in too, you know. So far there hasn't been a lot of people have been fired, a lot of positions have been filled, but so far whistleblowers have not had as much intimidation as they did under Obama.
Prathap, it's been a pleasure having you on.
Thank you for having me, Sasha. Always a pleasure to be back.
I've been speaking with Prathap Chatterjee, co-author of Virax, The True History of Whistleblowers, Drone Warfare, and Mass Surveillance, published by Metropolitan Books. And I should say it's co-authored by KPFA's own Halil Bendib. You can find a link to the book on our website, againstthegrain.org. And Prathap is executive director of CorpWatch. You can also find a link on our website to Drone Inc., which is a publication put out by CorpWatch. You've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening. And please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.